we'll hope to do here today and sort of set the parameters for this discussion. I'm a physician, a psychiatrist by training. I have studied and worked with informed consent in medical treatment and research for more than 30 years now, and teach a seminar at Columbia Law School on, one of the seminars I teach at Columbia Law School is on informed consent issues. So it's something that I come at both from the perspective of a practitioner, that is, I still see patients and I still get informed consent from my patients, at least I hope I do, and it's something that I've taught about and researched for many years. That being said, what I understand my job here today to be is to talk with you about informed consent as a concept that has developed within secular law and secular bioethics, and I'm not even going to make an effort to make the bridge to halacha or practice under a more halachic framework, which is something that I think you're going to be grappling with in the coming time, perhaps to start to grapple with already. In terms of how I'd like to do this, I would prefer that you stop me as we go along. If you've got questions or comments, there may be things I take for granted that are new to you and that I'm not being clear about, so let me know if that happens. And I will tell you if it's something that I plan to get to later, or else we'll just deal with it right there. All right, so the idea of informed consent is actually a remarkably new one. The first use of the term that we've been able to trace is from a in the context of medical treatment is from a court decision that was issued in 1958. And that may sound like a long time ago to you, but it's within my lifespan, and that seems relatively recent, certainly as far as most legal concepts go. Yeah?
One of the things we had discussed in the first day of class here was the distinction between the origin of a concept and the origin of a name. Do we know that it's a new concept just because it was called that before 1958?
Well, it was new in the following way. What existed before 1958, or actually the concept evolves before at least 3 years before the name is attached in a previous court decision in 1955. What existed back at least several hundred years, and perhaps longer than that, was the notion of something that we have called simple consent. Which meant that a physician was obligated before undertaking intrusive treatment or procedures on a patient to obtain that patient's okay, basically, to go ahead with the procedure. So the doctor would say to the patient, I propose to operate on you. We're going to take out your gallbladder. Is that okay? The patient would say yes, and the physician was covered. He was putter. No liability would attach to his behavior for an unconsented touching of an invasion of the bodily integrity of the patient. And let me give you an example of how this works. So the first recorded case about consent of any kind is from England in 1767. It's a case called Slater v. Baker and Stapleton. Slater's the patient. Baker was a physician, a surgeon, Stapleton was an apothecary. Back then, apothecaries, or what we would call pharmacists, did more than just stand behind a counter and dispense already prepared medications, they not only compounded medications, they got involved in diagnosis, they got involved in other forms of treatment. The boundaries between medicine and other professions were not as distinct back then. Slater had gone to Baker, the apothecary, to Stapleton, the apothecary, because he had previously fractured his leg, and it had been reset, and it had healed crooked. And therefore, he was having a hard time walking. Stapleton consulted Baker, who was a surgeon, and they decided that something had to be done about this, and they actually saw the patient three times. And on the third visit, Baker, with a nod to Stapleton, grabbed the patient's leg above the line of the fracture, and Stapleton grabbed it below the line of the fracture, and they twisted simultaneously in opposite directions, refracturing the leg and causing a good deal of pain to a very surprised Mr. Slater, and then reset the leg. Now, note several things about this. The first is that to this day, the way to correct a fracture that has healed improperly, healed at an ankle, is to refracture it and reset it. So in some sense, they were using a long accepted and continuing approach. That wasn't the problem. The problem was nobody had gotten Slater's permission to do that. So if they had merely said to Slater, who later brings suit against them, we think your leg needs to be refractured and reset, and we're prepared to do that. Is that okay with you? And he said okay, or he nodded, or in any other way gave his assent, they would have been covered, and we would not have this first recorded case arguing about consent in medical treatment. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I know very little about the history of medicine. What was the state of anesthesia at that time, and would there have been some sort of reasonable expectation that there would have been at least local anesthesia to make it less painful?
General anesthesia mm-hmm. comes in the 1840s.
Okay.
Local anesthesia comes in substantially after that.
Okay.
What you had in 1767, if the patient wanted to avail him or herself of it, was brandy. The equivalent. But there was no other anesthesia that would have been available at that time.
Would standard practice at that time to have been to give the patient some sort of alcohol before doing this?
Well, I mean, it's not entirely clear. We don't have really detailed records of surgical practices in that era. It certainly would not have been an uncommon practice. What we do know is that in the opinion, in the case itself, the judges say it has been the long-standing practice of surgeons to inform their patients of the proposed procedure and obtain their consent. And at least in part, that may have been so that the person could steel himself for having his leg refractured, whether steeling himself meant brandy, or it meant, you know, biting on a bullet, or you know, whatever technique they use. So that's the way things were. So what changed, and how did it change in the 1950s? And moreover, why did it change? Medicine at the turn of the 20th century was said by one of the most famous physicians of the era, Sir William Ulster, to have stood at best a 50-50 chance of benefiting a patient as opposed to harming the patient as a result of each encounter with a physician. And things get somewhat better in the 20th century, slowly, such that by the middle of the 20th century, we actually begin to accumulate quite an array of possible treatments for disorders. So a good example is probably breast cancer. In the late 19th century, there was one treatment for breast cancer. It was a radical mastectomy, which was developed by William Halstead, the surgeon at Hopkins, which involved removing the breast, the underlying tissue, some of the muscle underneath, and dissecting into the axilla, the armpit, and removing lymph nodes there as well. It was a fairly invasive way of getting rid of the disease, but it was the only treatment that was available. By the middle of the 20th century, by the 1950s, that was no longer true. Yes, they were still doing radical mastectomies. They were also doing less radical surgery. That is, they were doing so-called partial mastectomies. But radiotherapy was now available, radiation therapy, as was chemotherapy. So if you were a patient with breast cancer, you now had a somewhat more complicated situation. It wasn't a question of did you want the treatment that your physician was offering, in which case your only alternative would have been no treatment, but which treatment did you want? And likely, in order to make that decision, you needed to know something about A, which treatments were available, and B, what the risks and benefits of those treatments were. And although medicine was a little slow to catch on to this, the courts begin to recognize this in the 1950s. And the case that first lays out the doctrine of informed consent as we know it in American law, which is where it originates, and law in much of the world today, comes a few years later in 1960. It's a case called Nathanson v. Klein. It's a decision of the Kansas Supreme Court. As far as I know, it's the only landmark case ever to come out of the Kansas Supreme Court. But it is quite a famous case nonetheless.
But would you say the case was again?
I'm sorry?
Would you say the case was again?
The name of it?
Yes.
Nathanson versus Klein.
Nathanson.
Nathanson. I don't know if Klein was Jewish, but it sounds as though Nathanson was Jewish. Mrs. Nathanson was a woman who, in fact, had breast cancer and went to her physician who performed a mastectomy and who then referred her to Dr. Klein, who was a radiotherapist, that is, he administered radiation therapy. Which was a relatively new field at that point, and all the kinks hadn't quite been worked out. What they used was cobalt therapy back then. Radioactive cobalt emitted gamma rays, and with careful plotting of the area to be exposed to the gamma rays from a number of angles, one could ensure that the target at the center of those converging angles received more radiation than the normal tissues surrounding it, and therefore would die, while the normal tissues would be preserved. So Mrs. Nathanson agreed, that is, gave her simple consent to have Dr. Klein perform radiotherapy following her surgery, which he did. The consequences of the radiotherapy became apparent a few months later when she developed essentially a hole in her chest wall the size of something approximating a football, which ate through not just the overlying skin, but the underlying fascia and muscle and ribs in some areas. So this was not a good thing to have happen. And Mrs. Nathanson was understandably upset and brought suit against Dr. Klein. But what she said in the suit is what is of greatest interest to us here today, which is, admittedly, he asked me if I wanted radiotherapy, and I gave my consent for him to perform radiotherapy. I'm not questioning that. But he never told me what the risks of radiotherapy were. And if I had known that I could end up with a hole the size of a football in my chest, I would never have gone through with it. And in fighting the case up to the Kansas Supreme Court, that court ultimately decided that Mrs. Nathanson had stated a good cause of action, that is, there was a sound legal basis for her to proceed with her claim, because in fact a physician had the obligation not simply to obtain the consent of a patient, but to inform the patient prior to obtaining the consent of five things: the nature of the patient's condition. Recall, if you will, that it was common prior to the last 30 years still to withhold patients' diagnoses from them in many cases. A survey conducted in the late 1950s in the United States showed that about 90% of physicians said they would not tell a patient when they have cancer. They might tell the family, but they wouldn't tell the patient. By the late 1990s, that survey was repeated and the numbers were exactly reversed. Over 90% of physicians said they would always tell a patient.
When was HIPAA passed?
HIPAA?
Yeah.
HIPAA comes in the last 10 years. The fight over HIPAA takes
and
place
before,
at the
so
turn
before
of
that,
the
there was no legal bars to telling the family without their consent?
There may have been ethical rules, and over time there would have been state law that raised issues of that sort, but in fact it was a common practice. And the further back you go, the more common a practice it becomes. HIPAA becomes effective, I think, in 2002. So you've got to tell the patient the nature of their condition. Mrs. Nathanson, you have breast cancer. Second, you had to inform the patient of the nature and purpose of the treatment. We propose to do radiotherapy on you to wipe out the remaining cancer cells that may have metastasized prior to the mastectomy that you had performed. Now, if we stop there, we'd have something very much approximating the doctrine of simple consent. If we stop there, the court would not have changed the law, innovated the law in any way. And moreover, Dr. Nathanson would be fine. I'm sorry, Dr. Klein would be fine. Mrs. Nathanson's claim would not be valid because she had given her consent. She knew it was going to be radiotherapy. She knew it was to kill the residual cancer cell. But the court continued. Moreover, the physician has to disclose the risks of the proposed treatment, the potential benefits of the proposed treatment, and the alternatives to the proposed treatment along with their risks and benefits. That is a sea change in the way medicine conceptualized what was supposed to be happening in that physician-patient encounter. And it had all kinds of implications. But note first that merely telling a physician that he or she has to disclose these data doesn't tell the physician how much he or she has to disclose about each of those items. So consider risks, because that's usually what's issue at issue in these cases. Yeah.
Sorry. Was Ms. Nathanson's claim that that she would not, if she had known the risk, that she would not have chosen this particular treatment, or that she found out about this other treatment and she would have chosen the other treatment? I'm wondering if the last of the these five things is something that was something that she was seeking in her case, or if this was something that the court invented.
It appears, and I'll tell you why, all we can know is what it appears, that her claim was that she would not have had this treatment.
And would have had a different treatment.
That's not clear.
Oh.
That she would not have had this treatment. And the reason why the factual record is a little thin is because this case goes up on appeal on a challenge to the underlying cause of action.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no trial from which an appeal was brought. The defendant's position said, wait a minute, based on the allegations in the patient's claim against me, there's no legally valid cause of action underlying...
Oh, so this was on a motion before it ever went to trial.
That's right.
Wow.
Okay. So that always means that the facts are a little unclear in these cases. As far as I know, it never goes to trial. My guess is, although I can't be positive, that this was settled
yeah.
after the decision of the Kansas Supreme Court. Only a tiny percentage of malpractice cases go to trial. 90% or so get settled before trial, one way or the other. Any other questions at this point, actually?
When did this become accepted outside of Kansas?
So we'll get there. but let me tell you first about the question sort of hangs in the air after Nathanson. And that is, how much information do we have to disclose? So consider risks. For any medication that I might prescribe for one of my patients, I could go to a fat book, actually much of it's online these days as well, called the Physician's Desk Reference, which many of you have seen, which comes out each year in a new edition, which lists the information approved by the Food and Drug Administration with regard to the uses of dosages for risks and likely benefits of medications. And under the section on risks, in small print, I can find for the typical medication anywhere between 50, 60, 80 risks listed. These are all things that have happened at some point in association with taking this medication. Sometimes they've happened in controlled trials where we can say, well, they didn't happen any more frequently with the people who were on the medication and the people who weren't. Therefore, it's not likely it's the medication, although we can't be sure. And sometimes they're just reported by people in practice, and you never know, really. You know, so you took a medication, the next day you have a stomach ache. Well, are the two connected, or is that pure serendipity? So there's a whole list of these kinds of risks. Do I have to disclose all of them to every patient? How long does that take? How long do I have to spend explaining to them what each risk really means? All these conditions with funny names. Yeah.
This has to be given verbally, it can't be in writing?
Well, perhaps it can be in writing, but it's got to be in some form communicated to the patient. Yeah.
So, like, when you get a prescription filled, the pharmacist, you know, gives that, you know, paper
right.
in the bag with all the risks written on it, that's not enough?
Well,
actually
no, that's not enough. That is there to cover the obligations of the manufacturer of the medication. But the physician has an independent obligation as an independent licensed professional to make his or her own disclosure to the patient.
Right.
And whether it's in writing or not, we'll get back to you.
So
that's an interesting question.
From my own experience, I haven't really been prescribed anything stronger than antibiotics, but no doctor has ever sat down and spoken about risks of medication with me. It's always just whatever they hand you at the pharmacist.
Right. Okay. And keep that thought, because that turns out to be a very important thought. and it reflects an experience that my guess is we've all had. I know I've certainly had. And will be important, but it'll be important towards the end of my talk. So I will get to it. Well, the courts dealt with this uncertainty on the part of the medical profession in one of two ways. They said, look, here are things you have to say, but how much you have to say, and here's option one, depends on what another reasonable physician would have said in this circumstance. So it's what's called the professional standard of disclosure, which keeps it within the provenance of the profession, the scope of decisional power of the profession, which in fact is how most malpractice law works, which is to say, malpractice is a deviation from the accepted standards of care of the profession. So it's the profession that really gets to determine what constitutes malpractice or not. Yeah?
So the doctors get together and say, we don't like these, you know, intrusive informed consent rules. We're going to all just decide as a group we're not giving any information anymore. You can take our advice or leave it, and that's it. That would be fine according to the standard.
Well, so there's a problem with the professional standard, isn't there? And that's exactly what began to dawn on people. Moreover, in addition to the fact that the profession might set the standard, but set it so low that it did not support the underlying premises of informed consent, which is with more information, patients will be able to make better decisions, more meaningful decisions about their treatment. There's also the possibility that there may not be a standard, that it may not be something, as was probably the case with Dr. Klein, that the profession never thought about before. And so you had an inchoate standard, and how does that then get litigated in court? And so jurisdictions that were concerned about these issues moved to a different standard, the second option here. First is a professional standard. The second option was to require disclosure of that amount of information that a reasonable patient would want to know. Not what a reasonable doctor would disclose, but what a reasonable patient would want to know. The so-called reasonable patient standard, it's also called the materiality standard because it's framed often as that information which would be material to the decision of a reasonable patient. Sometimes it's called the lay standard of disclosure in contrast to a professional standard of disclosure. Yeah.
So again, a reasonable patient with a college degree, a reasonable patient who's a high school dropout.
So it turns out that, as is true in much of law, there is an irreducible ambiguity in the standards that are formulated by the courts and have to be applied in real concrete cases every day that come before these tribunals. And it turns out not to be uncommon when we, all of us, try to apply abstract principles to concrete cases, that one can never formulate a rule, or at least it's extraordinarily difficult to formulate a rule that has a sufficient degree of precision to take all the questions out. And if you try, there's always something new that you didn't think of, or always an unexpected consequence of greater precision. And so the law often offers these standards of fairly broad generalities that then have to be applied in particular cases. So who decides what a reasonable person would have wanted to know? Do you know what the answer is in a malpractice case, an informed consent claim?
The jury.
12 in most jurisdictions, reasonable people, or presumably reasonable people, who get to decide what a reasonable person would have wanted to know. Now, I say that and swallow hard, because I start jury duty tomorrow morning at 15, so we'll see just how reasonable I turn out to be.
He probably would Duncan not put you on a case like this because you couldn't be expected to be reasonable as a patient, given that
I would expect that as a physician I would be allowed nowhere near a medical malpractice claim of any sort. Now note that each of these standards has advantages and disadvantages. On the professional standard side, the advantage is that from the court's perspective, the problems of proof are relatively lessened. How do we know what the professional standard is? How do we know?
Ask the doctor.
Ask a professional, right? Or ask five professionals. So expert witnesses are brought before the court, and sometimes I serve that role as well, and somebody says, well, you know, what should a reasonable physician have disclosed here? And the expert opines as to what a reasonable physician should have disclosed. How the expert knows is another question, which if we have time we can get into if you're interested. That turns out not to be so easy. But the disadvantage is the disadvantage we talked about, which is, well, you know, maybe it's not good enough. Maybe if we're really interested in helping patients make meaningful decisions, leaving the standard in the hands of the physicians, that doesn't do it for us. On the patient-oriented standard, the reasonable patient standard side, the problem is that it becomes ambiguous what a reasonable patient would have wanted to know. Moreover, it's not clear that even that is the same as what this patient would have wanted to know. Because this patient is a particular person with particular fears, particular needs, particular concerns that a reasonable patient might not have. So a violinist might be very interested in knowing the likely effect of a surgical procedure to relieve contraction of the musculature in his hand on his subsequent motor function. A psychiatrist may be, you know, mildly interested in that, but not quite as concerned. But a reasonable person might not need to know that in detail, and so even a reasonable patient standard doesn't get you necessarily exactly where you might want to go here. About half the jurisdictions in the United States have endorsed a reasonable patient standard, and about half the jurisdictions stick with a professional standard. And there was a marked swing over the years toward reasonable patient standards, and then they swung back to some extent as concern grew in the late 80s, early 90s about the number of malpractice claims that were being filed. And legislatures saw this as one way of making it harder to win and therefore less desirable to file malpractice claims. However, the usual rule of thumb, regardless of the standard of disclosure, and believe me, most physicians have no idea what the standard of disclosure is in their jurisdiction. Massachusetts is a reasonable patient state, is that the physician should disclose major risks, even if they're not terribly frequent, and frequent risks even if they're not terribly major. So, you know, if there's a 1% chance that your skin might fall off if I give you a particular medication, or which is to say something called Stevens-Johnson syndrome might develop, I should probably tell you that. You might decide that's not a chance you want to take. And if there's a 90% chance that you'll experience dry mouth, or a little bit of sleepiness, or other minor annoyances, well, if it's that certain, I probably ought to tell you that too. You deserve to know that. Less major, less frequent, it's a little unclear. And that's where some of the line drawing problems come in. Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely does. Yeah. Going to dental school?
No, I just noticed dentists lie a lot.
You mean when they say this won't hurt?
No, particularly in regards to when things have to happen. So basically, long story short, I found out that I was getting wisdom teeth, and it was right like 3 days before I was flying back to Israel. And my friend's father-in-law was an oral surgeon, went to the oral, and he just saw me, and he said, oh, it's not going to bother you for 5 years. You don't need to do it immediately. And he said that they often say that you need to have these surgeries done immediately so that you don't they don't lose you as a customer, so that they get the money from it. Because otherwise you're going to see someone else. And I've heard that from numerous dentists, so I was curious.
Well, do they have an obligation to obtain your informed consent? Yes. Do economic interests play a role in what, you know, almost all of us do at some point in our lives? Hard to deny that. What your dentist did, I have no idea. I have no idea. Now, so far, we've talked about informed consent as if it always applies in all circumstances, and regardless of any other considerations. And that turns out not to be true. So there are four generally acknowledged exceptions to the rules we've been talking about, which otherwise would appear to apply broadly to medical and related, practices. And I want to tick through those with you now. One is in an emergency. It would be silly and, in fact, counterproductive if you were brought into an emergency room after an auto accident with a ruptured spleen, bleeding to death. Spleens sit right over here, right, which is where the steering wheel is in the car, so the most common serious injury for the driver. Particularly if he or she is not wearing a seatbelt, is a ruptured spleen. Big deal. You can bleed out before they get you to the hospital. At that point, if they do get you to the hospital, it's a good reason to wear a seatbelt, by the way. You probably don't want them to take the time to talk to you in the emergency room about the options of surgery, or there's really no other approach, surgery versus not surgery, what the risks and benefits are, the incision they plan to use, what the scar will look like, whether the surgeon will leave his initials as part of the scar or not, all the possible things you could say to people at a time like that are not what you want to hear right then, right? A reasonable person would want the surgeon to move as quickly as possible to the OR and get that spleen out before you die. And in fact, that's exactly what the law holds as well. So since it is presumed that in a genuine emergency, a reasonable person would consent to standard of care treatment, informed consent is not applicable in those settings. Now note, not everything that happens in an emergency room is an emergency, and not all emergencies occur in emergency rooms. So one has to look in particular at this situation. And the question that one has to ask is, would the time it takes to go through the disclosure with the patient substantially increase the risk of morbidity or mortality, suffering or death, on the part of the patient? And if the answer is yes, the obligation does not exist in that context. So that's the first exception. Questions about the emergency exception? It's probably the most clear-cut. The second exception to the laws of informed consent, the rule of informed consent, is what is usually referred to as waiver. And waiver is based in the notion that it would be very odd if a doctrine that was formulated to encourage individual autonomy in decision making, the right of the patient to make a decision about the options with which he or she is faced. It would be very odd if that same doctrine required the patient to do things that he or she didn't want to do. So the patient who says, "Doc, I don't want to hear all that stuff. It confuses me. It scares me. Just go ahead and do it," has waived their right to the disclosure of the information, but obviously has retained their right to make a decision, because they've said, "Go ahead and do it." They might say, "I don't want to hear it, and I don't want the treatment." That's legit, too. And when I hear physicians, usually though not always, younger physicians, physicians in training, say to patients, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith, but the law says that I have to tell you this." Or even worse, "The law says you have to listen to this." Both of which I've heard, I always get a chill down my spine, because it means the physician has essentially misunderstood what's going on here. Yeah.
So, anytime you give someone a right, the ability to waive a right, it creates a situation where they can be coerced to waive that right.
Absolutely.
So, how do you avoid a situation where doctors say, I don't want to get involved with the whole informed consent business, I'm not treating anyone who doesn't waive their right to it?
Okay, so let me answer that, but let me hold the answer for 20 seconds and just say that there's a second form of waiver, which is waiver of the right to decide after having exercised the right to receive the information, which is to say, I listen to the whole list of risks, benefits, alternatives, their risks and benefits, after which I say, as patients have said to me over the years, "Listen, doc, I didn't go to medical school. You went to medical school. I can't make a decision about weighing all this stuff. You do what you think is best." So they've heard, but they don't want to decide. They want me to decide. And that's okay, too, says the law. Now, there's a real issue, which is the question that was raised, and it's absolutely true that whenever you allow a right to be waived, questions arise about how voluntary the waiver of the right is, and whether there might not be coercion that's exercised in order to get the right to be waived. So how would one imagine that happening in a medical setting? Well, how might you imagine that it would happen in a medical setting?
The physician can refuse to treat if they won't sign the waiver.
Well, yeah, I suppose, although that's pretty blatant. There are other ways to do it.
A long and complicated waiver form where nobody wants to read it and just, you know, sign this at the beginning.
All right. Or maybe more simply, since I'm thinking about it in a little more simple-minded perspective here, the physician says, Mrs. Smith, you know, I could go through all these risks and benefits over the next 15 or 20 minutes, but I know you need to get home to your daughter. Is it okay if we just skip that? Now, is that coercion? Well, no, not in any strict sense of the term. Not in the sense of I won't treat you if you don't agree to waive your right to the information. But it's certainly a manipulation of the patient in a circumstance in which you'd expect better of the physician. So once you embrace waiver, the possibility for that sort of behavior exists. And I think it is real and inescapable. And I'm not sure there's a good way around it as long as you endorse waiver. There are lots of problems with informed consent. My general sense, having studied this for a long time, is that abuse of waiver is not a major issue. There are other major issues, but this is probably not a major one.
I mean, I think doctors a lot of times don't want to give information because they don't want the patient constantly second-guessing them.
Right. So there are lots of reasons why doctors don't give information. And we'll talk about those or some of those, but I'm just suggesting waiver is not a principle, although the potential for abuse is there, that in practice gets abused a lot.
Right. I mean, like, I just share a personal story. I mean, when my grandmother was in the hospital after she had a stroke, my my father and my aunt were trying to get information to the doctors about what parts of her brain were affected, and they were answering in, like, the kind of answers you would tell a six-year-old, and my aunt is a chemist, my father has some training in biomedical engineering, they could have fully understood whatever the actual answer is, and doctors clearly did not want to give it to them because they didn't want them second-guessing the treatment.
No, and I think that is absolutely a real phenomenon, and there are, as we'll consider, a number of, no small number, of reasons why, in practice, informed consent looks different than it does in theory, as we said earlier, we've all experienced. But let's get to that in a little while. Any other questions about waiver? All right. So the third of the exceptions is something that goes by the name of therapeutic privilege. And in many respects, it may be the most problematic, at least if it were used to any great extent. Therapeutic privilege was written in by the courts into some of the earliest decisions about informed consent, and it still echoes today. Therapeutic privilege says the physician has the privilege to withhold information from the patient if the physician has good reason to believe that the patient would be harmed by the disclosure of the information. Now, you could imagine circumstances in which therapeutic privilege would legitimately apply. Anybody want to offer one here? Yeah, go ahead.
You're going to die within the next month. I don't know. Like, I feel like a lot of times that's something that doctors aren't so eager to tell patients when there's imminent death on the line.
Yeah, I think it's certainly true that they're not eager to tell them. There's a question as to whether they may overestimate the degree to which patients would be adversely affected by that information. It turns out when you study those situations, in fact, most of the time patients already know at some level how ill they are and are actually relieved to have somebody talk with them about it. But it is certainly true that if you gave physicians the discretion to withhold that information, they might elect to do it in precisely those circumstances where it might prove to be counterproductive. So that's certainly a problem with the doctrine. Yeah?
If the information would really upset the patient, and
their condition might last. OK, so an example might be, well, go ahead. You were going to offer.
I was going to say something that the patient can't do anything about. Like if you're a carrier of a disease, and doesn't actually have any impact on you, but you
well, that's interesting. Right. Sometimes there might be information that would do more harm than good for you to know it. That is, there's nothing you could do about it. Now, there are some complicated discussions we could have about what your right is to that information anyway, or at least your right to elect to have it. So I might say, look, I know something about your genetic status. I can tell you, or I cannot tell you. You tell me what you want me to do. Yeah.
Could be a situation in which the doctor knows certain things about how the patient is going to react based on things that they have from their doctor-patient relationship, especially about family history or particular reactions to certain types of illnesses or certain types of treatments. Like, it could be that, you know, if you know that this patient's, you know, sibling or parent happen to have the same illness or had a particular treatment and, you know, and that didn't work very well or something like that, then that might create irrational fears in the patient.
Okay, so you might worry in some circumstances that revealing information to the patient of that sort would actually end up impairing rather than facilitating the patient's decision.
Right.
Because they would get so upset or become irrational in some other way. So arguably, that's an example of a circumstance in which therapeutic privilege might apply. Yeah.
Do you think a patient might be religiously opposed to a certain kind of treatment?
Well, so one thing that therapeutic privilege can't mean, logically can't mean, is that if the disclosure would lead the patient to reject the treatment, that the disclosure shouldn't be made.
Unless the doctor's convinced that any religious reason is an irrational one.
Right. But one has to say that...
I mean, what about, like, Christian Scientists?
They probably aren't in the doctor's office in the first place.
No, but they end up in the hospital.
For some reason I can't do it, but according to that whole reason, it's an irrational belief in Jewish law. Right?
Yeah, go ahead.
What about, this is, I guess, more patient-specific, but if you have a patient that has a certain psychological disorder or something that could then cause them to have an adverse reaction to certain information. So, you know, I don't know what those might be, but I can imagine a patient that has, that might, I don't know, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, a paranoid psychotic patient who is terribly suspicious of everybody around him and just barely was able to bring himself into a medical setting in the first place, to go through an extensive list of the risks of treatment, arguably is just going to drive him away, not to his benefit, and certainly not to the benefit of informed decision-making. So let me just say what the danger is. The danger of therapeutic privilege is that it can be the exception that swallows the rule. That is, if you construe it as, look, the right thing to do here is to have treatment, and if I give the patient this information, she's going to refuse to have the treatment, and that will harm her, that means that I'm entitled to withhold that information because that will do her good. And that can't be what therapeutic privilege means. It can't be what it means because the whole point, you might say, of the doctrine of informed consent is to give the patient the right to say no. Because without the patient's right to say no to something while retaining the right to say yes to something else, or no to everything, informed consent really has no substantive meaning. Yeah?
Can you clarify about thinking about it in terms of what the doctor has to disclose that the patient has the right to refuse. I'm thinking specifically of a hypothetical situation where a patient would, for example, be in need of an organ transplant and would be open to the treatment, but would not want it if they knew who the organ was coming from.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
So they're open to the treatment, but then would have some other kind of notion. Would the doctor have to inform them of where the organ is coming from?
Well, that is interesting. So, one question, and there are certainly cases like this, you know, do you want to walk around with an Arab kidney? Or would an Arab want to walk around with a Jewish kidney? Or a white with a black heart?
Sure, kidney.
Et cetera. Whether the identity of the donor or the racial identity of the donor is material to the decision of a reasonable patient, and it's the standard that gets applied for informed consent disclosures, and arguably it's not. If it's a match on the HLA antigen typing, that's probably what's material from a medical perspective. But of course, patients want to know things that aren't strictly material, either because they're curious or because they have exactly these kinds of prejudices which might induce an irrational reaction. And although physicians are ordinarily obligated to answer patients' questions honestly, this might be one circumstance where you might want to make an argument that, although the physician shouldn't lie and say it's from, you know, somebody who's white when it's really from somebody who's black, maybe this is a question the physician doesn't answer. Maybe the physician lies by saying, I don't know. Or maybe I can't tell you.
Or that could be therapeutic privilege to not answer.
Or maybe it's arguably therapeutic privilege. Yeah.
So I think with the organ transplant, we could have a great case of this. I mean, as we know, there are a number of folks who think that cardiac death equals cardiac death, and therefore you can't do heart transplants because you're murdering the donor. But let's say I have a patient now who
holds like those postgame, but doesn't know, holds like those postgame that cardiac death is holotic death, but doesn't know that you have to, kill the donor to take the heart. If the doctor tells them that, they'll refuse the treatment and they'll die. Does the doctor have to tell them that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I want to answer it as I stand here at the moment, but it is an interesting example of how information can have complex effects on people. And the reflexive stance that many people assume of saying patients have a right to know and therefore everything relevant to their treatment should be disclosed to them is in many respects too simplistic. It gets more complicated than that, yeah.
I was wondering if the laws of informed consent are different based on whether or not the person being informed is the patient himself or an agent, GAL, someone with power of attorney, say for a patient who, you know, is mentally incompetent or unconscious.
Right. So how might you think they'd be different?
Potentially, I mean, one possible difference is whoever this agent is who's appointed is someone who doesn't know everything that the patient knows. There could be, you know, there could be things about the past history of this patient that they wouldn't, there are all sorts of experiences that where this person's decision might be different from the patient's. My instinct is that you probably would not need to tell the agent as much as you would need to tell the patient themselves.
So let me say, to start the response to that, that what you're talking about is the fourth exception to informed consent. The exception of incompetence.
Okay.
So although every patient is presumed to have the right and the power to give or withhold consent for his or her own treatment, that turns out not to be true for those patients whom we call incompetent. Now, what we mean by incompetent is a topic that...
Of course. But does that mean that the
rights... consume a great deal of time and attention.
Does that mean that the rights of informed consent get transferred to a different person, or does this fall into the category of therapeutic privilege and those rights get retained to the doctor?
In theory, if you look at what the text will tell you about decision-making by substituted decision-makers, they will say that the disclosure that would have been made to the patient is instead made to the surrogate.
But that doesn't happen.
It turns out in practice it feels different.
Yeah.
If you're talking to a surrogate than if you're talking to the patient. And the kinds of questions that get asked are different as well. Maybe more global, maybe more tending towards the surrogate's interests as opposed to the patient's interests, even if that's not supposed to happen. Like, well, if we do that, how much longer is this going to go on? Which the patient probably wouldn't ask in quite the same way. So it feels different in that context. But your question presumes a reality, which is just worth stating explicitly, which is when somebody is incompetent, someone else gets to make the decision for them. Now, historically, it was the physician who made the decision for them. But in recent years, that has come to be seen as inadequately protective of these interests that the patient has in having an appropriate decision made, in part because the physician is thought to be overly biased, if you will, in favor not just of treatment versus no treatment, but of a particular kind of treatment that he or she would recommend. Yeah?
If you're going on the notion that a patient is incompetent to make his own decision, then who's given power of attorney? Because wouldn't the patient decide that? And if he can't make a decision for himself, then how can he decide that someone else is completely safe that the person who's given power of attorney is any more competent than him?
Good. So who gets to make the decision? How do we know
next
the identity of the person? So if the patient has identified a surrogate decision maker in advance, and these days every state, including Massachusetts, has provisions in its law for a document known as an advance directive, which would allow me to say, if I am ever incapable of making a decision for myself, I want my wife to make that decision for me. I'm sorry?
I'm thinking specifically in the case of mental illness.
Right, no, let me just get there. It turns out that although these documents have existed for probably over 35 years now, only about 15% of the American population has filled one out. This despite the fact that a federal statute passed in 1990, the Patient Self-Determination Act, actually requires that every time one of us goes into a hospital or sees a new primary care physician for the first time or signs up for a health plan, they are required to ask us if we would like to fill out an advance directive. Despite that, only about 15% of the American population has one. So 80% of the time on average, 85, we're not going to know who that person is. We don't have someone designated by a competent patient, and obviously by definition the patient may be incompetent to designate such a person, although put some parentheses around the fact that some people may be sufficiently impaired not to be able to make their own decisions, but may retain the capacity to designate someone else to make the decision for them. And one often sees that with older people who have some degree of cognitive impairment, but, you know, they come in with their son and they say, I don't really understand, but why don't you tell my son, we'll do whatever he says, which is fine. In the absence of that kind of designation, traditionally under the common law, we looked to family members to make these decisions. Many states now, although by no means all, have adopted statutes that go by the name of something like the Family Medical Decision Act, in which they designate a hierarchy of decision makers, just to make this crystal clear. So it's usually spouse, well, first somebody designated by the patient if such a person exists, spouse, parents of a minor, adult children, and then people of lesser degree of relation. Statutes differ in how far down that list they go. They also differ in whether they include non-married partners, which is something that the gay community is very interested in. And they, some of them stop short after a relatively short list. After children usually come siblings. Some stop there, some will go on to relatives of lesser degrees of relation. States that don't have those statutes, and there are still plenty of those, will usually rely on the common law presumption of close family being able to make such a decision. But in those states, if a son disagrees with a spouse, a little less clear who really gets to make that decision. Presumably it's the spouse, but, you know, often those cases end up in court.
Like the Terri Schiavo case.
Well, like the Terri Schiavo case, where spouse and parents disagreed. Now, in fact, I'm told, although I don't know Florida law in detail, that it should have been clear under Florida law that the spouse got to make the decision. But because of the sensitivity of the case, the courts refused to sort of say that definitively, and so we had the spectacle that we had with Terri Schiavo. Yeah.
To go back to when we were talking about therapeutic privilege, to what extent can a doctor, or is a doctor required to allow a patient to make a decision that will necessarily cause them harm or put them in a situation of imminent death? You know, like let's say it's a 98% chance or something like that, is the doctor still required to let them make that decision?
And there was a case here in Massachusetts of a woman who had gangrene up her leg. Gangrene is a fairly common consequence of long-standing diabetes or vascular disease. There's not enough blood flow that's getting to the distal extremity, and a small injury occurs, a cut that would otherwise heal, which doesn't heal, and gangrene develops. The fear, of course, is if the gangrene bacteria spread through the rest of the body, you can die of bacteremia, and so the usual treatment is amputation. And so she was hospitalized with her consent and was told that she needed an above-the-knee amputation in order to take care of the gangrene on her foot. And she refused. She was a 80-plus, maybe 85-year-old woman, Italian woman, immigrant. Her daughter had brought her to the hospital, very much wanted her to have the amputation. The mother said, my daughter doesn't make my decisions for me. She never has. Hinted that they were stated more explicitly that they didn't get along very well with each other, and therefore she didn't want her daughter to make the decisions for her. And the case goes to the Massachusetts courts precisely because of this reason. Because the physicians say, well, look, if we let her make this decision, then she's going to die. And her only chance to live is to have the amputation. It winds its way up to the Supreme Judicial Court here in Massachusetts, which holds that informed consent doesn't just apply to trivial issues. It applies to all medical procedures, at least unless one of the exceptions applies, and therefore her refusal had to be respected. Now, I've worked here in Massachusetts for many years, and I was here during that case, which was on the front page of the Globe. It was a major cause célèbre a number of months, and I became curious whatever happened to her, because she was allowed to refuse the treatment, and she did refuse the treatment. Sometimes you hear about people who, after they're given the permission to say no, change their mind and say yes. She didn't change her mind. So I looked her up in the Globe Index. I looked up her obituary. I had a hunch that they would have written about her. It turned out they had her obituary, which was dated 7 years after the court decision. Turned out she hadn't had the surgery, but she also hadn't died of the gangrene. She lived another 7 years, either into her late 90s or late 80s or early 90s, and passed away from another unrelated cause, which is a little ironic, but it does underscore that physicians, there's a certain degree of uncertainty that attends every diagnosis, every statement of prognosis, and in fact, every treatment that one could select. We're often behaving empirically as physicians. We take our best bet as to what's probably going on based on, you know, all the tests, all the measures. You still don't always know for sure, and you take your best, I'm hesitating to use the word guess, but your best estimate as to what the effective treatment will be, and you try it. And if that doesn't work, you revise your estimate and you try something else. But that case really underscores the uncertainty that that exists in all of these situations, but it also underscores the fact that informed consent applies even if the patient's refusal of treatment would lead to the patient's death. Yeah.
What's the typical time frame for an informed consent case? Because I realize a lot of these situations might be quasi-emergencies and that decisions would need to be made by courts faster than the typical pace of litigation.
An informed consent claim against a physician
right.
Will take years to wind through the courts. It may be 3 years or so before it comes to trial,
right.
Much less appeal. Cases like this,
mm-hmm.
where a more immediate decision has to be made, the courts have...
They make injunctions.
...mechanisms for acting more rapidly. So there is, just like there's a physician on call in every hospital, it turns out there's a judge on call.
Right. But
who can deal with
and
emergency.
And does it even happen on the appellate level for these sorts of cases?
No. Well, if it's an appeal of an emergency determination
yeah.
by a lower court, yes, it can move very quickly. And there's I could give you examples, which we don't have time to do, of cases where that's happened, and the appellate judge has gotten a lot of flack for getting involved at that level. Really basically at the bedside,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to stepping back into a more removed judicial stance towards the case. This famous Jehovah's Witness case called the Georgetown Hospital case, which dates from about 1960, which exemplifies that issue from the D.C. Circuit. Yeah.
So we held that the doctrine of informed consent applies even to a course of action which will necessarily cause the patient's death. How do we square that with the fact that most states criminalize physician-assisted suicide?
You didn't tell them not to ask hard questions. So. there's no question that this is an issue in law, the whole question of what's the extent of patient autonomy, that's still being worked out. We started from an extremely paternalistic stance in the early to mid-20th century. We introduced the notion of informed consent. In the latter part of the 20th century, we developed what many people call the consumer approach to medical treatment, which casts the doctor-patient relationship in the framework of any other kind of commercial relationship where the consumer is purchasing a service without the overlay of thousands of years of a very different kind of relationship between doctors and patients. It's a desacralization, if you will, of the doctor-patient relationship, for better and for worse. But we're still not done working out all these issues. So in a society that wholeheartedly embraced the notion that patients get to decide what they want to do with their lives, period, even if it means ending their lives. Logically, one could argue that includes the right to say to a physician, I want you to help me end my life. And yet, in most states, not all now, but most states in this country, physician-assisted suicide is illegal. The exceptions are Oregon and Washington. And the U.S. Supreme Court, when it considered the case, said that there was no constitutional obstacle to states barring physician-assisted suicide. Can you reconcile the two? Well, on its face and at the most superficial level, no. It seems to be a violation of the principle of autonomy. But principles rarely stand alone. And autonomy, arguably, is not the only good that one takes into account when one thinks about medical decision making. There are other considerations as well. And I think the courts would probably say, you know, in terms of respecting the sanctity of life and protecting the integrity of the medical profession and preventing abuses of a right to assisted suicide, that they've decided not to go that far. Yeah.
Right. So I can accept that sanctity of life is an exception to informed consent, but then that should apply to any course of action that would necessarily lead to the patient's death, not just you know, the active physician assisted suicide. I don't see the ethical difference between the active and the passive.
And many people don't. Many people would argue that allowing this older Italian woman who said, I was born with two legs and I'm going to die with two legs, to refuse amputation, thinking, as everybody did, that that would lead to her death, is really not substantively different than having her turn to her doctor and say, can you write me a prescription for barbiturates so that I could end my life. But let me tell you, without going into it in any greater depth at the moment, that not everybody would agree, that they would argue that, in fact, one can't just look at the autonomy interests here, and that other principles deserve weight and might well weigh heavily enough in the balance to lead us to the conclusion that the two are not, in fact, equivalent. And I'm actually on that side. I fear the consequences of a movement toward assisted suicide, some of which we've seen in Holland, which has, if not a formal statute allowing assisted suicide, at least a declaration by the prosecutors there that they won't prosecute assisted suicide unless it appears to be abusive in some way, in which we have seen a creep from that to and over the next dividing line, which is assisted suicide for people who are not capable of requesting suicide on their own, which is to say euthanasia. And you know, in the 20th century, we had our experience where that can lead, and it was not a happy experience, particularly for Jews. So, you know, one doesn't raise that specter casually, but there are reasons to hesitate before going in that direction. Let me ask you, Rabbi Clapper, how much longer you want me to go? I started a little late, but you tell me. These guys, I know, have had a long day.
I think that we should, I think we should probably end in half an hour, but I think we'll probably be able to try and push them to, push them to sort of find things.
Well, let me then go no later than 5:30. But let me turn to just present one last issue to you, and then we can talk in general about this. And that is to get back to this point that was raised very early in our discussions about why the reality of going to the doctor seems so different from anything I've been talking about here this afternoon. And I will tell you, it's not just your experience because you're younger or because, you know, you're not yourself physicians. I am a physician. Some of the people who have taken care of me over the years know that one of the things that I do is study informed consent, and I'm not sure my experiences are very different than yours. A disclosure of the kind that I've described to you is almost unheard of. And the exception is for major surgical procedures, which, thank God, I haven't had, but I've had minor surgical procedures. And even there's a form where one has to give one's consent, and on which one will often be able to read, at least, a disclosure of some of the major risks, even if nobody takes the time to talk with you about it. But this doesn't look like what goes on in the real world, even though physicians know that they fail to obtain informed consent at their own risk, because they can, in fact, be sued. And we didn't get into the technicalities of it, but let me just tell you that suit is brought as a variant of malpractice. There was some debate as to whether suit for failure to obtain informed consent should be considered a kind of assault or a battery, an unconsented touching. But the courts, for a complex set of reasons, decided to treat it the way they would malpractice. So physicians who are sued for failure to obtain informed consent are covered by their malpractice policies, and all the rules that apply to malpractice cases apply here as well. Some of which benefit the patient litigant and some of which don't. So why is that? Why doesn't it in practice really look like what we've been talking about? Indeed, when you see something that goes by the name of informed consent, what you most often see is a form that gets handed to the patient, written in small print and, in many respects, the worst combination of medical and legal jargon, which is often uninterpretable, which we know because there are these many studies that have looked at the forms and what's on them and how complex they are and how they're well beyond the reading level of most patients. Why is that what happens instead of anything more substantive? So let me put it to you. Why do you think the reality looks so different than what the law is?
It's really impractical for common treatments that are used on the day-to-day basis. You know, every time a dermatologist, you know, told somebody to put aloe on his skin, he had to, you know, go through this whole process. It would just take forever, waiting at the doctor. We already wait. I usually have an hour and 15 minutes at every doctor anyway, even though he told me what the appointment was. I wouldn't want to wait another 2 hours so, you know, he could explain to somebody the risks of aloe lotion.
So one answer may be that the costs of informed consent were underestimated by the court, particularly the cost of applying it globally to medical practice. When informed consent first comes along, there are some courts, some states that toy with the notion that really this just applies to invasive procedures. It doesn't apply to medications, for example. It just applies if I'm going to stick something into you. Scalpel or a catheter or something of the sort. But really in practice, it doesn't get limited in that way, and yet it doesn't get applied. And part of it is the reality of medical practice. Doctors are busy. They're always running late. There are always more patients in the waiting room. And if they take the time to have the discussions with the patients, they feel that that will negatively impact other patients out there, and so that's one reason, I think, in fact, why these discussions tend not to take place. What are some of the other reasons? Yeah.
I think that patients are becoming increasingly more informed on their own. So, like, if they go for, let's say, a vaccination or something like that, they already have a lot of information on it, so the level at which doctors need to give them more information might be less.
Now, the internet has changed the dynamic of the doctor-patient relationship. 20 years ago, it was pretty hard to get medical information. You might have to go to a medical textbook. Most people didn't have medical textbooks. Most libraries that were available to those people didn't have those textbooks. The textbooks were filled with complicated language and were hard to maneuver through. Now you go to the web, you type in, you know, your condition on Google, and up comes a variety of web pages you can go to specifically written for you, the patient, in ordinary language, from the Mayo Clinic, or from Ask Your Doctor, or from a variety of other websites, including your own doctor's website, which often have these kinds of connections. Links that enable you to get to this information easily. So perhaps very recently, but only very recently, the doctrine has become less meaningful simply because more information is available and one doesn't have to rely on the doctor for it. Yeah.
And because of availability of information, the doctor may assume the patient already knows what the effects and symptoms of this are.
So doctors may assume that patients know more than they actually know. And in fact, that long predates the internet. That is, One of the problems with a reasonable patient standard, a reasonable person approach to this, is that physicians long ago stopped being reasonable persons, which is to say they went to medical school. And they learned all kinds of things, that it becomes very hard for a physician to realize most people who didn't go to medical school, even if they're very intelligent and very highly educated in other areas, never learned things about anatomy and, you know, where the liver is and things about the possible consequences of medical treatment or how much it hurts if you stick a catheter in somebody's arm, all those kinds of things, which makes it hard for physicians to empathize with patients' desire for and need for information. And that gets in the way as well. Yeah.
Violates the Hippocratic Oath.
Tell me why.
Hippocratic Oath, you have to swear that you'll act for the benefit of the patient, which is not necessarily for the autonomy of the patient.
I was going to ask about that.
What were you going to ask?
So then how do doctors reconcile acting on the behalf and for the better of the patient and allowing patient autonomy, which may allow patients to choose otherwise?
How do you reconcile?
You answer your own question. The patient's autonomy is what's in the best interest of the patient.
Is that how
the
we're redefining?
Patient decides what's in the best interest of the patient, not you.
So that's how we're now defining the best interest of the patient is the patient's own decision as to what's the best interest.
So as treatment options multiply, think back to the breast cancer example, it became more generally accepted that the person who best knew what was in the patient's own interest was the patient herself. That the only person who could weigh whether the risk of a 30% chance of recurrence without mutilation of her chest wall versus a 10% chance of recurrence with a radical mastectomy, which involved massive mutilation, was worth it. Only she knew where that balance should be struck. And if you ask how it's usually reconciled, that is how it's usually reconciled. You may buy it or you may not buy it, but that's how it's usually reconciled. What else gets in the way? What about the information itself?
Too complicated.
Some things are intrinsically complicated to explain to people. And moreover, before you can explain to them what the potential side effect of, merely that there is a potential side effect of renal failure, well, now you have to explain to them what renal failure means. And what are the implications of renal failure? You know, does it mean you're going to die? Does it mean you're going to need a transplant? Is renal failure permanent? Can it be transient? If it's transient, how much are you going to suffer in between by the time your renal function returns? So there's a great deal of background that is often needed to assimilate this information in any meaningful way. So the nature of what has to be communicated often gets in the way of physicians communicating it. Yeah.
Also, most of the risks are generally such a remote possibility. It makes it even less worth the effort.
Because we do we test our drugs and our treatments much more so now than they were before.
But also, I mean, a lot of side effects. You have, you know, a 1/100%, if that, chance of getting it.
Right. So remember, all you're obligated to disclose
what
a reasonable patient would want to know.
No, but you mentioned earlier that there was the standard of things that are either likely or severe. And especially when it comes to the things that are severe and very unlikely. A lot of patients may not even want to know that.
Right, that's certainly true. But in a reasonable patient jurisdiction, there's a cutoff somewhere. If there's a 1 in a million chance of death from an anaphylactic reaction to aspirin, which I don't know the exact number, but there is. Some people get anaphylactic reactions and die from aspirin. I don't know any physician who would disclose that or any court, I think, that would require that to be disclosed. So there's a limit. Nonetheless, I think we can say that there certainly is a sense among many physicians that some of this is just so unlikely to happen. And moreover, the information that it's going to happen is so unlikely to be of use to the patient that I'm just wasting my time going through this kind of disclosure. And sometimes physicians' opinions are based on their own experience, namely having discussed things with patients and then having the patient look at them and say, well, I don't know, what do you think is best? And then doing what the physician recommends anyway. And the physician, you know, over time comes to believe, well, if they're just going to do what I recommend, then why do I have to go through all this in the first place and take everybody's time for it? And so they begin to back away from their commitment to sharing this information. What else might get in the way here? Ever try talking to some physicians? A little hard sometimes. Physicians are not necessarily selected to be the best communicators, right? They've got the best MCAT scores. They had great grades in college. You know, maybe they spent their summers working in a molecular biology laboratory, none of which necessarily prepared them to have a discussion with a patient who had a serious illness that they might die from about their treatment options. And so some physicians are wonderful communicators, and they make TV shows about them, but others are terrible. And, you know,
they make TV shows about those too.
Yeah, that's right. you know, they may try and fail, or they may feel so awkward about it that they don't even try.
I wonder that it seems to me like that when you say that the profession has changed to a consumer model, probably physicians haven't shifted to, you know, because a lot of physicians push back against the whole consumer model, and so the whole notion is against the self-image of what doctors are. And second, I was wondering whether anyone has come with the notion of an informed consent specialist, as opposed to having the specific doctor. Like, why not have somebody, you know, who's right, who's the liaison with every patient, who's trained exclusively to be able to translate medical jargon into reasonable decision-making statements, as opposed to taking. I mean, I think you'd have to change the nature of the profession to make people really effective communicators. We don't require that of garage mechanics, right, where mostly we all just hand it over to them, and nobody expects anyone to understand what the mechanic is telling them. So I'm wondering whether this is at all a reasonable model.
Yeah, you know, I've actually suggested something like that in the research context. That is, consent to research turns out to be a particular problem because it's even more complicated than consent to treatment, and researchers are even seemingly less able to communicate what needs to be communicated to potential subjects, and therefore it seems like a reasonable thing to do. But in practice, without going quite as far as I think what you're suggesting, things like that happen de facto. That is, it's not always the physician who obtains consent, or at least not always the physician who does the disclosure. Many practices may have nurse practitioners, for example, who actually go in and talk to patients before surgery, or physician's assistants, who aren't quite specialized educators, but they are the ones who do more of this kind of disclosure and therefore may get better at it and see it as more part of their role than the surgeon does, who, you know, just works from morning till night and spends relatively little time talking with patients. So I think that certainly is happening and does happen, although I'm not sure anybody's thought about it in quite that systematic away, yeah.
I was just saying, in practice, I think pharmacists play that role in many ways.
So there are, it turns out, a number of substitutes for a physician who's able to talk with a patient, in part because of the realistic obstacles of time, in part because of the problems of the complexity of the information, in part because of some of the other things we've talked about, like physicians not necessarily ipso facto being good educators. Other ways have been found to communicate at least some of this information. Some of you who've had surgery may have experienced being exposed to videotapes about, or you know, these days DVDs about the surgical procedure, where a high quality discussion takes place on the screen with pictures and diagrams and you know, explains to you what it is the procedure is all about, instead of the surgeon spending his or her time doing it. And you see that increasingly in other medical settings as well. People are experimenting with this in medical research settings, too. Lisa is a nurse. Lisa.
Well, that's thank you. In my experience, what I've seen is that the ancillary staff are the people who do much of it. There's sort of the initial explaining by the surgeon or the attending doctor or whatever, and then there's the social worker and the nurse practitioner, and we are the people who explain it in terms that are appropriate to the individual, in particular to that particular individual. So that's how it seems to sort it out.
And you won't find that described in any theoretical discussion of how informed consent should work. But de facto, this is what goes on, particularly in inpatient settings, where these auxiliary staff tend to be present. They don't necessarily see themselves as auxiliary, but they certainly are not the physicians on whom the doctrine of informed consent, as embodied in the court decisions, has almost exclusively focused. So the system has found workarounds to the reality that physicians just aren't doing a very good job of making these disclosures and seem to have relatively little interest in doing a better job of it. Did you have, no, I thought I saw a hand over there. There are a couple of other things just to keep in mind about what makes this so hard, because it really is hard. Part of what one would need to disclose in any realistic discussion with a patient is the uncertainty that attends the entire situation. We mentioned this briefly before in a different context. The uncertainty of the diagnosis, the uncertainty of whether the treatment's going to work. There are very few treatments about which you can say to the patient, I'm 100% confident that this is going to work, because you're never 100% sure that it's going to work, and if you are, you shouldn't be. Doctors, it turns out, don't like talking about uncertainty. There is something about the omniscient, almost godlike figure of the physician that's hard to give up if that's what you've cloaked yourself in. And it's hard to be humble and to admit that there are things that you don't know. And that is something that puts physicians off about this as well. There's a wonderful book by a psychoanalyst, psychiatrist psychoanalyst who taught for, now passed away, Jay Katz, taught for many years at Yale Law School, was a professor there, called The Silent World of Doctor and Patient, in which he talks about just how hard it is for physicians and patients, for physicians to communicate with patients, and focuses in particular on this discomfort with uncertainty as a causative factor.
And thinking of myself, you know, as a patient in patient mode, so I suspect that I'm less interested in making decisions among competing treatments than I am in making decisions among doctors. And therefore, you know, probably one of the primary pieces of information I want to know is how good a doctor are you, and what's your track record about. So where does that fit in the doctor is currently constituted, and does that contribute significantly to the discomfort with playing a doctor out of practice?
That's very interesting, actually. And this is ground that's sort of shifting as we speak to some extent, although slowly. As originally formulated, the doctrine of informed consent was about the treatment, not about the doctor. Over time, questions have arisen about whether it should be extended to include characteristics of the physician as well. So if I'm a surgeon, should I be obligated to tell you how many times I've done this surgery and what my record is? Or at the very least, if you ask, should I be obligated to reveal that information? If I'm not a surgeon, if I'm an internist or a psychiatrist, and you come with a particular condition, should I be obligated to tell you how often I've treated it before? What about if I have economic interests that arguably are relevant to your decision to trust me? Like if I'm being incentivized by the HMO for which I work to reduce costs of treatment, should I be obligated to tell you that? What if I have a relationship with the drug company that's making the medication that I'm recommending for you? Or if I'm a surgeon and I'm implanting a prosthesis in your hip and I have a relationship with the equipment manufacturer that's going to get $10,000 for the prosthetic that I'm planning to use in your surgery. Do I have an obligation to tell you that as well? And finally, in this, you know, these broad categories, what if there's something else about me that might influence your decision as to whether to have me be your treater? For example, what if I have a little bit of an alcohol problem? Or, you know, I used illicit drugs and I got caught and now I'm on probation and being monitored for it. Should I have to tell you that? What if I'm HIV positive? In the early 1990s, this was a big issue as we started identifying HIV positive physicians, and it wasn't clear how easily communicable the virus was. So the courts started to struggle with these issues, and they're not done struggling with it. How far have they gotten right now? It's a little hard to generalize, but I think in general, physicians are recognized to have an obligation to respond honestly to patients' questions. And even without a legal duty, many hospitals are proactively disclosing things like track records of the facility as a whole with particular kinds of operations, not necessarily of particular surgeons, and economic relationships, which is now a current major focus of physicians with pharmaceutical companies or equipment manufacturers. But this is a moving target. I suspect we're going to move in the direction of greater obligations to disclose these sorts of things, but it's not been a small step to take to say, at the very least, if you ask, how many people like me have you treated before with this kind of condition and with this kind of procedure that they have to respond honestly, which I think most courts would agree that they do at this point. Yeah.
Hospital track record in terms of particular procedure isn't necessarily indicative of their skill level, because they can get a very high track record simply by refusing patients that they don't think will have a high survival rate.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, although the feds are now posting hospital performance in a selected number of categories on the web, you can find it. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services collects the data. There is a great deal of debate about what that really means. And maybe the best place you could be treated is a high-volume academic medical center, which is a major referral center for the most complex cases, and therefore has not the best track record in terms of ultimate outcomes, because it's dealing with the highest risk people to begin with. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's just an intrinsic problem with using that approach, those numbers. Yeah.
So a question regarding the therapeutic privilege. If a patient directly asks about for more information or specific information, is the doctor allowed to say, you know, no or withhold that based on therapeutic privilege, or once the patient is put on the table, it's required for the doctor's care?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of ambiguity there, but I would say that these days the physician is probably obligated to respond to specific questions, even if he or she would be inclined to not to reveal the information ab initio.
Two other questions. One is, you're describing a scenario where there's a huge gap between the theory of theoretical requirements and what actually happens in practice. To what degree does the court struggle against this gap? Or to what degree is the gap the same as the, say, between the speed limit and on the actual speed of traffic, which is a theoretical thing, but the enforcers know perfectly well that the theoretical thing isn't supposed to exist in practice, and so they just end up applying it arbitrarily at whatever level they want.
But for that second gap, I would have been even later, so don't knock it. That's there are people who would say that, and Jay Katz, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, was one of them, that it is in fact the courts that are the problem, that have been the problem, because they created a concept, they created an image of what a doctor-patient interaction should look like, and then they immediately began undercutting the enforcement of that presumed requirement. He believed that actually failures to obtain informed consent should be pursued as batteries, not as acts of malpractice. Malpractice policies don't cover batteries. Physicians would have been out of pocket for claims of this sort. And he also believed, which we haven't talked about directly here, that one of the other major problems was that before a patient can bring a suit, a claim for failure to obtain informed consent, there has to be a bad outcome. Okay? So if I don't tell you about a risk, the risk has to materialize. You have to have suffered as a result of that risk materializing. And then you can sue. And in suing, you allege, if I'd only been told about that risk, I never would have gone through with the procedure. Jay Katz argued that that set almost unsurmountable obstacles for patients, and that we ought to do it very differently. We ought to allow patients to sue for what he calls, or what the law would call, dignitary injuries, which is to say, if I fail to give you the information, that's a wrong in itself and a harm in itself. And you should be able to claim against me for that. Now, he, to keep the courts from grinding to a halt, would have done something like what your speeding analogy implied, which is to have a system of what he called tort fines, where rather than having to go through a whole complex procedure, if it could be demonstrated, although exactly how is a little unclear, that I failed to disclose information to which you were clearly entitled, a reasonable patient would have wanted to know it, and you could demonstrate that, then I would have had to pay a fine, which would have gone to you as the patient. So, you know, 500, 1,000, 10,000, whatever. That would have facilitated the enforcement and gotten the profession's attention, right? Like, wake up, guys, can't get away with it anymore, we're getting serious. Now, there are all kinds of practical issues to Katz's proposed solution that really he never worked out before he died. But it's interesting, and it reflects a perspective which is different from most people's, which says the courts, rather than being, you know, the ultimate champions of the patients here, actually have been extremely conservative, even reactionary in their approach to the doctrine, have been overly protective of the medical profession. But you said there were two questions that you
had. Okay, so first one, the second question I'm going to ask you is, what accounts for the variability in whether physicians are good at this? And particularly I'm interested in this relative learning, whether philosophic commitment to autonomy has any effect whatsoever on the way, right? Do people see the connection? Are you driven that way, that you really believe in patient autonomy, that you really do inform, can really do informed consent, and if you really don't, you really, right, or is it really a personality of all that matters, and those are just both sides of justification.
Yeah, so, I mean, the data are actually pretty interesting, and I don't have it all right here, but let me answer as best I can. There have been studies looking at physician characteristics, and also looking at patient characteristics. So physicians who make less money as physicians tend to disclose more. Physicians who are politically liberal as opposed to conservative tend to disclose more. Physicians who will espouse more of a patient's rights view of medical decision making will tend to disclose more. These are correlations, it's not an absolute yes, no, but they tend to disclose more. But there's clearly an interaction between who the physician is and who the patient is. Women get more disclosures than men do. Maybe in part because women ask more questions than men do. People of higher socioeconomic status get more disclosures than people of lower socioeconomic status, maybe because the physician believes they're better able to understand and use the information, maybe because the physician is more afraid of being sued by somebody who's more sophisticated. There are a number of studies demonstrating correlations of that sort. So yes, there are physician characteristics, but it's also interactive with who the patient is. So if you pair male to male, it's the least disclosure. Female physicians disclose more than male physicians, but not necessarily more to female than to male patients, whereas male physicians will disclose more to female than to male patients. So you get this sort of a complex nature. So maybe we ought to take a couple of last things and then wrap up. Yeah.
So whether or not you call it battery, malpractice insurance insures doctors against making mistakes. Why would the insurance companies insure them for willful violations of the law?
So that is what somebody who favors a battery-oriented approach would argue.
I'm not talking about legally whether we call it battery. From the insurance company's decision, what? They could write whatever policy they want. Why would they be willing to write this policy?
Well, what the policy says is you're covered for acts of negligence, and then medical negligence. And then it's up to the courts to determine what constitutes medical negligence. The courts have chosen to see informed consent as a negligent act rather than an intentional tort of battery. For a complex set of reasons. Let me just touch on some of them. One is the courts are clearly uncomfortable analogizing the physician who omits disclosure of a particular risk to a patient to somebody in a barroom brawl who commits a battery by slugging the guy on the next stool. Those seem sufficiently disparate to the courts that you can just see the judge's discomfort with putting them in the same category. Secondly, there is a good deal to be said from the patient's perspective for considering this malpractice rather than battery. One is that the patient now has access to the malpractice policy, which is usually well in excess of the assets of the physician. I'll assure you, my malpractice coverage is well in excess of my assets. You'll do much better off suing my insurer than you will suing me. Thirdly, the statutes of limitations tend to be longer for malpractice claims than for batteries. Usually a year for battery. Malpractice is typically 3 years, although it varies a little bit from state to state. And if you're a minor, it's much longer. It's until you become an adult in your own right, and then there are various exceptions. So it goes back and forth. There are things to be said both from the physician's perspective and from the patient's perspective for why malpractice is a more desirable way of dealing with this issue that I think in aggregate account for the approach that the courts have taken here. Let me just close then by saying a couple things in the end. I am myself a strong advocate of informed consent with patients. How good a job do I do? I guess you'd have to ask my patients that. I'm probably not in a good position to judge. But I think it's important. I think it's important even if patients may not use the information to make decisions, even if they still rely on what the physician's recommendation is in the end. It's important because it helps, A, those patients who want to be more involved, to have a mechanism by which they can become involved and in an informed way. And secondly, for those patients who may not even care how much they get to make the decision. It's important as well, I believe, because it changes the nature of the physician-patient relationship, making it somewhat more of an equal relationship, or at least one in which there are mutual aspects of respect that are being transferred. So the patient respects the doctor because the doctor has knowledge that brought the patient into the office in the first place, and presumably the patient also hopes that that physician will be a caring, trustworthy kind of person. But requiring the physician to transmit that information to the patient is a kind of requirement for the physician to manifest his or her respect for the patient, saying, look, I see you not as my 2 o'clock to 2:15 appointment, but as another human being who's in pain and distressed and worried and not sure what to do. And let me just tell you what this is all about. Let me try to explain it to you. I may not do a great job. You may not know how to use the information, but you know, let's try to communicate as people for a few minutes here before my next patient comes in. That it doesn't always work, and certainly doesn't always work that way, is indisputable. That it could work better, I think, is clear. That there are certain intrinsic limits which will stop it from ever becoming the ideal that, you know, the courts may have imagined in the 1960s, 1970s. By the way, in answer to an earlier question, it's the early 70s when it becomes adopted in a widespread fashion around the country. That's all true. But nonetheless, I think it has a very important contribution to make to the humanization of medicine and of the doctor-patient relationship. And on those grounds, if no others, and I think there are others, is worth our support. So, yes.
One last question.
One last question.
How is the doctrine that has failed so signally to be implemented become universal? And so rapidly.
Yeah, well,
does it work anywhere? Is there anywhere in the world where medical practice looks anything like the doctrine?
No. There are a fair number of countries in the world that have adopted a fairly close simulacrum of the American model. But there's no evidence that it really works differently in those places than it does here. So why? What accounts for its spread? I think it's a very powerful idea. This notion that we ought to, there was a court actually in the early 20th century in New York, in a case called Schloendorf, a very famous case coming out of New York Hospital on the east side, in which the decision was written by Judge Cardozo, who later becomes Justice Cardozo, the second Jewish justice on the Supreme Court, in which he says every adult human being of mature years and sound mind has the right to decide what should be done with his body. And that's a very powerful notion. And it's a notion that is difficult to argue with from the patient's perspective, and it underlies what informed consent is about. It bespeaks a respect for the individual that many societies, not just ours, claim. And so it's hard to argue against the notion, the idea of informed consent. The reality turns out to be quite different in many respects, but that hasn't been enough, oddly, to stop it from sweeping the globe, if you will. And in those parts of the world where medicine is still largely paternalistic, you will find the more advanced members of the medical and legal professions in those countries themselves looking to the West to help them bring informed consent into their countries. We were in Japan, a decade ago, I guess. They translated my book on informed consent into Japanese. I can't tell you if they did a good job or not, but they were very interested. Is that what goes on in Japanese medicine? Never has. I doubt if it does today. But somehow they see that as an ideal to which they should aspire as well. You know, there are these powerful memes, and the meme of self-determination in the medical setting is I think, one of them. That's a good question. All right.
There are other reasons too, but that's the main.
Thank you. I think Lisa will handle that on Thursday.
Yes.
She was in touch with you.
No.
No? No, she was just. But that, I mean, how does things spread? It doesn't work. I mean, that's it.
But you can probably think of other things. Communism.
I spread on the illusion that it's working.
Well, we may have an illusion about it.
Because what you do is you have a course on informed consent.
Three times a week,
for on our left side of the homework for the
No, but you think
well, you're going to
you think you focus on less.
I don't think so.
You think that we covered
the you think that the stuff that we've been doing, let's say, for the past couple days about
owning your body? It's like
owning your body.
Really, you know, watching
right? The connection by that.
We're looking at.
Would you be justified in including that in
yourself? Yeah. I have to wait until you finish reading all the questions. No, we're in research. But what we're doing is
even more.
I agree, like, it's really appropriate for what we're doing. But we're now in research. So, any professor giving a course
After
finishing
research, we should have this discussion again, right? In another 4 weeks and say, was there a way we could have presented this thing that would have been better? Because I actually have a hunch that if we were in law school and we were taking like a seminar on informed consent, I think it would look just surprisingly similar. I don't think it would be exactly the same.
You've gotten to the point that it would just not work, because when you give a lecture, absolutely, exactly, you in 40 minutes be still in the best possible organized school that what the students should know, right? And then if they want to do further research, they go, well, you can go exactly. This is totally different from what we're trying to do, which is basically produce your own treatise and let's consider
no, here, I agree.
Yeah, so I'll say, I don't really think the two are
incomparable.
No, I think they are countable.
There could be a good
I
think my family
where somebody could, like, decide to do this. On top of that,
we just bring her in. She's refused to bring the medical weight down because we walk in as a team of five or something like that.
They come up after
the second you wait for any idea.
Exactly.
As you told, like, as the Gemara here is basically completely alien to, except for the fact of the way the day is structured, right? I don't think, meaning Seder and then Shir. Because that doesn't exist in the Western Academy, right?
If you haven't read the novel, you're still kind of catching up.
Earlier, and with very different groups that were in Nuremberg, and then the scandals that break preceding and leading up to the speech, and then federal regulations, whereas the consent to treatment doctrine evolves in the 50s, admittedly, after Nuremberg, but as best I can tell, completely unimaginable by the knowledge. You know, based on common law, as opposed to the regulatory approach that's taken in the research.
Yeah, Steinberg directly treats the informed consent, medical informed consent that's stemming directly from Nuremberg. Interesting. I think that I guess Actually, I wonder if you don't think it changes the perception of the medical profession, but indirectly that is there less trust in medicine at that point, or is that just the Jewish community thing?
Well, you know what happens in the wake of that? Physicians, in particular, researchers, I think people more generally had a way of writing it off as completely aberrant. That is, as reflective of what not
right.
The ultimate evil would behave this way. But that's not us. You know, we're good caring doctors who care for our patients. And in fact, even the researchers who looked at the experiment in the concentration camps, Mengele and the others, said, well, first of all, that coercive experimentation on unwilling prisoners, that's not what we do. And secondly, we're not Nazis. So, you know, that was a great decision. It applies to Nazis and it applies to research on unwilling subjects. And that's unacceptable. And now just let us go back to what we do, which in many cases is research towards getting consent from the patients who are the subjects of the research. So it had much less of a direct impact than many people might believe.
Is your sense that there's a really big racial difference in America and how this functions? You talked about gender. Some of the parade cases are African Americans who have totally different attitudes towards the medical profession.
Right. So, I mean, there, on the patient side, there's no question that there are data that African American patients are more suspicious, less trusting of the medical profession.
So they have the
same. Less information, I'm not sure. There may be data on it, but I just don't recall that I'm standing here. But that probably plays into social class pretty heavily as well.
I have read a number of things. I just read John Grubman's book, a number of things, which seem to imply, and you have the AIDS conspiracy theories, all things like that, that there's, you know, that somewhat stemming from Tuskegee, somewhat not, that the level of suspicion is so great, they don't believe the information anyway, and that drives a counter-reaction where doctors are much less willing to give them information about risks because they're afraid it will be one of Grootman's parade cases is where people are unwilling to, where if something goes disastrous because someone's plan is rejected because of a risk, right, some kind of risk factor. And
I
don't know what interesting. It's not a. I haven't heard it as my auditor, so it wasn't systematic.
No, it's anecdotal. It's interesting. Jerry was in the yearbook, he got called Mr. Pre-Med for our graduate class. He was a classic, driven, single-minded pre-med. And, evolved into a staff writer for the New Yorker. Never would have guessed it, but
all right.
Well, I ought to hit the road.
Okay, thank you again so much for coming.
Is your group Davin Mitchell already?
We haven't done it yet, but we're not planning to Davin on school.
I made the same offer.
Just out there.
Dee Dee? No, I'm gonna go down there. Oh, that's not here. How many?
Oh, she got it. I feel this was like the nymph of Myra's. I did go see.
I was going to say that's such a surprising one for this era of shul to have something quite that elegant.
Yes, true.
I just was, you know, because he's very type
of
a little bit.
Punch of everything else that's around.
And it, but it's a nice room. It has rafters and it has a little bit of a grace note. And you know, given
what Temple Sinai are. Well, I know you know these things, but
right.
No, Temple Sinai, that was their social hall. That was their sanctuary.
Wait a minute.
Their sanctuary faced my ass.
I have been meaning to look into this more carefully. I love thinking about architecture, and I, you know, if I'm in a place, I always go look. And clearly, historically, not everybody followed that. There are many Orthodox synagogues in this world that could have
why you're facing the old day tradition why you faced north.
So what
the main auditorium faced west.
Okay.
The shul in the basement of the dormitory faced south, and there was one little minion, my father's minion in the classroom, that allegedly was started by Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who claimed he had been rabbi of a Hasidic shul in Europe, and so he wanted a Hasidic minion. So he started a Hasidic minion in this classroom that faced east, in which he davened the Sukhashkarav.
So this is ancient and
widely practiced, the facing east thing. And then you run into these shuls, like YU, that don't. So what's
well,
up with that?
Here's an added question to throw in, not actually the facing, but the facing part. I, you know, it just dawned on me on this past Shabbat, why do we turn to Ma'arav to welcome the Shabbat Kala? Should be coming in from the Mizrah.
Let's face the door.
Yeah, wherever the door is, no?
That's what I thought.
They all just turn around.
Doors can be funny, actually,
it became much more complicated than that because it's because of the Mekubalim used to face Meron. And then it was actually
face Meron.
So that's
okay.
Historical basis, but then Kabbalistically. No.
Okay.
No. And then they would turn.
Although that would have archaeologically the old shuls in the Galil. Some of them face east.
You always face Jerusalem. Yeah.
No. There are shuls
that would be
that face east. And I thought there was some documentation for that. Some early discussion about which way you face. With some Rabbeim, I've never really
heard of it. I heard of the great circle tradition.
Yeah.
My issue, maybe that's a recent issue, because there's not many others, but we had
high in folate, all those medications.
You would think. I said, oh,
yeah,
you're fine. Oh, there's
medical
college there,
right? And they showed up in the hospital.
But he's doing chemical engineering.
They gave us these informed consent forms, and wouldn't treat.
Yeah.
No, until we signed them.
He's a little,
and that was so far we were stuck because my sister
the
liked the histological effect. And they wanted charcoal.
I know.
And right, and they conflict.
Some of them
are too far. So I was like, you couldn't not do anything.
Right.
And what was the purpose? Like we understood that we did nothing. Terrible things were happening. So right, in giving this one, it was just a, I think about a lot of what was going on there. Right, there we were in a pediatric emergency room.
There's
no conceivable way anybody could explain that.
Guys, Allie is in Ames, Iowa.
But they needed to cover themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We had the core.
Yeah.
He's actually working
at
a project to turn
to
cover themselves.
Oh, really? In the absence of a genuine commitment to informing patients, they've at least picked up that they can get sued, at least they think they can get sued. And so they do what they think is going to stop them from getting sued, including doing things that make it more likely
to
turn like having somebody come in.
Actually,
I'm going to go down and find the ladies.
Yeah.
We really have to
go. Yeah,
or else. Paul, it was good to see you. Those are all fascinating topics. The things that we talk about it all the time. So at some point we'll talk more talk about them. But it was. I had to run out, but it was very interesting.
Say hi to Mark.
I certainly will. Robert Hubbard, it was great. Thank you for organizing this.
Thank you. Always.
Alright, well, I have to go.
Thank you again.
Grand
Child 2. Oh,
yeah.
How often
are you up? We see them up for every 6 weeks, but sometimes they come down. So we come up. I mean, we're up a fair amount.
That's kind of the point number three.
I wish they were closer.
Right.
They're not the ones who move. We're the ones who move.
Well, you only have to be on the market.
I'm sorry?
Going
to market, and I mean that's what we always said, right? But we had no idea where they would end up. So.
I
had emailed you.
It's just a question of whether you agree with it.
That's his thesis. It's an interesting thesis. It's a very interesting
thesis. I think if he's right, then that's really what it is. It's not practical at all. It's totally a question of whether you agree with these ideas. And if you don't, then,
No, I think it's very... I think what you're thinking about in terms of the law, there are all sorts of standards that you simply won't be able to enforce.
Right, that's a big,
Speeding
is my pet peeve. Every time we're on the highway, I start speeding. It turns out the court is just arbitrarily easier. We went to jury, the jury's just arbitrarily.
We started executing people for embarrassment.
Well,
those folks, you know,
or just arbitrarily, you know, informed consent just depends on what the judges throw in the jury. That would be bad.
And yet it seems to be what the gate is. It's like,
I don't know what this informed consent violations is. I like J.J. Katz's thesis that it's a violation of equilibrium.
Right,
that's what it is. Yeah, exactly. Right, it's a violation
of equilibrium. Right, so I'm just curious if
anyone ever sued if they
didn't have a bad outcome. I guess it'd be lucrative, yeah.
If you don't get money,
like a real industry, it's like if you're going into a hospital, like there'd be lawyers lined up outside. They wouldn't get ambulances, they just stand at the door.
Whatever I'm saying, it would be like, it's going to be like Miranda rights. You only need one big lawsuit, like the Miranda rights, and it's like, no, this is what they have to tell you no matter what. If they don't, you can sue for that.
Say, this is just for
yes.
Efficiency.
That's what it is.
The Miranda rights are the same issue. The Miranda rights get formalized.
Exactly. Right.
And then it becomes completely
meaningless. Exactly yeah. Right.
So you lose both ways. So it's not like it's impossible to enforce.
Well, that's why we get Lechatchila standards.
Right. I mean, this is like, they have all these amazing scenes on like Law and Order with like Miranda rights. It's like. You know, like the criminal is like begging to be able to, you know, talk to the prosecutor. The prosecutor is like, nope, Miranda ruined that for you, and walks out of the room. It's like the lawyer's not here, I'm not talking. Like,
yeah, no, there's that. And there are also, of course, the scenes where they read your Miranda rights, right?
If you go
turn off the video camera. What? The rights are in the turn back on you. Anything you say maybe it's against you, turn it off.
I mean, I can't tell.
I was reading a Lee Carre novel, which is actually a scene where, you know, they're interrogating the guy, and they turn off the tape recorder. You say, you know what that means, don't you?
What?
I think that's a really big issue. Like, figure out, you know, whether this is what goes on with a standard that never happens. What's the purpose of that? I have a hard time getting.
It's like agnostic values.
They never happen? Is that like we see that guy never
happens?
There
are some of them that like they're unenforceable. They're ethical standards to which we aspire, but no, we'll never achieve.
That's serious.
But that's what, you know, better the story. But the rhetoric is there.
Yeah, but if all it is rhetoric, then you've got to, you know, you've got to be very careful. I mean, I almost fainted. Like, you have this amazing truth of our Shlomo Zalman, where he's like, well, Miri says it's not literal, but Tzitzis and Rabbeinu Yonah have always shown him. Well, all think it is literal, but no one says Chalav Shabbos, Chalav Shabbos to protect someone from embarrassment, so it's not really murder. He's like, well, he goes to the whole Shuvah trying to figure out what exactly it means. And then he's like,
why rabbis need to cultivate a literary sensibility.
And then he's like,
it's not really his fault so much as his
and then he's like,
Rashi knows immediately on the
record.
And then he's like, no one ever said that you can't. He's like, what happens if someone's running after someone to embarrass them? Can you kill them? I think the issue there is
the problem of quality. Like, I don't have any problem with the thesis that you should be able to chal Shabbos to prevent somebody from being thoroughly, irreparably humiliated. But I have a problem with the notion that you can, right, that you can chal Shabbos to stop somebody from having a pie thrown in their face. But we don't have a standard of... Our standard of halbanas panim, because the issue there is, and that's a very common agada halacha issue, but it's not an issue that the notion that embarrassing somebody is tantamount to killing them is agadah. The notion is what agadah often does is it deliberately confuses the standard and uses rhetoric that is appropriate at the top end, right, without making it clear that it doesn't apply universally.
Right.
So I always
and of course, in that case, is even more complicated because everyone points out, like, Well, if you're ever going to pick a case of where embarrassment would be a bad thing, it's where the guy doesn't deserve it. And here, Yehuda deserves everything
that's
coming to him.
The riot is hopeless.
It's absolutely hopeless. Like, Yehuda deserves everything that's coming to him, and still...
Yeah, the riot from tomorrow is hopeless, but the principle...
Right, and yet that's what we're working
about impossible standards.
And yet that's what we're talking. And people are like, well, on the one hand, he deserved it. The other hand, it was her fault. She may have been justified, but she did it.
Yeah, that gets invested about the third issue, the unclean hands doctrine issue.
Right, exactly. So it's like, everyone's like, if you want to take that Gemara, it's like, yeah, just throw it, you know, throw your head in the air and God knows what to do.
Yeah, no, I think I would distinguish between that's a very different move to claim that you're taking something literally that's not meant to be taken literally, and you're taking something at the wrong end of the standard. I think at the wrong end of the spectrum. I think those are different.
But I think he also answered the question of why we have this standard, even if it's unsuccessful. It's just to give the patient that sense of he's being part of the medical practice and we're doing what's in his best interest.
That can be. How would you translate and tell us
about? What I expected him to say that he didn't
not
say
at all,
is like not about like the feelings of the people involved, but rather that if something bad does happen, then now the person has legal recourse.
They have legal recourse without informed consent also. They have legal recourse just like claiming that you had a bad outcome, you did something terrible. Informed consent didn't mean that... Informed consent is a prior restraint issue. You could always sue for bad outcomes afterwards.
Well, no, let's see, with the lady with the...
With
a large hole in her chest, right? She agreed to it beforehand, but the issue really was that she just didn't know what the risks were.
That's right, because you could always sue for a bad outcome that came out of unreasonable medical practice.
Right, but if it was reasonable and he actually didn't tell you, meaning like. You know, now in the places where it's really a risk, like physical therapy that might end up giving
right.
you hope, I have time believing that she's just going to give you like paperwork and not actually tell you that
I don't know. I think first of all, informed consent often becomes a way of protecting doctors. Like even if outcomes came out in case that you said it's okay, it's a way of protecting the care that much for the whole doctor, and that's why I'm funded. Right, to some degree.
I mean, any case cut those ways.
But
increased standardization, and I think people usually think that this tends to help, by and large.
Help what? Help you sue or help you not sue? Or help you?
No, help maintain everybody maintaining responsibility for their actions, I think people agree is like an end in itself.
I don't know if it works that way. Especially since it's like most doctors don't understand the law well enough to know what's likely to get them sued or not.
Yeah, but most doctors know that there is a law saying you better let them know what the risks are if something bad might happen to them.
I don't know.
What if something's a 2% risk and you don't want to discourage the patient because it's such a horrible...
Yeah, so I'm saying, like borderline cases, obviously, are going to be different, for really obvious cases now, it's been ensconced in the law that this is something that needs to happen.
That's an interesting how much, I asked an actor that said, maybe it's just that we have no conception of what it was like before.
What I thought was really crazy about in terms of what it was like before was when you said like in 1910, like every treatment for everything had like, you know, on average had a 50-50 chance of helping rather than hurting.
Yeah.
It really helps you understand recommended.
Oh, I thought
that. No, that was clear. I knew that.
Well, I think that may shift. It doesn't necessarily mean before 1910 it wasn't higher at some point, but historically.
Right.
Historically, depending on what's...
Historically,
there's
one of
the...
Historically,
in the Gemara, there's an inversion of
doctors. Yeah. Western countries, when they have such... They die of remarkable things that we don't even have to deal with. And, and then people say, oh, look how terrible it is in, say, Gaza. Right? And, we're in the West Bank compared to, Israel or other Western countries. And it's because... Their standards are so much lower, and we just don't realize it.
Now, we assume in medicine, but the truth is that, and this we'll talk about, the truth is that we radically overestimate the extent to which medicine is scientific on many, many issues. You know, I think which would probably frighten most of you. You know, there's a movement in medicine called evidence-driven medicine. This is highly controversial, and most people don't accept it.
Meaning only treatments that are...
That there's evidence for.
...proven to... Okay.
Most...
Wow, really, okay.
This is a radical move, and
it's
a radical move, but highly controversial.
How much of medicine would that do away with if we adopted it at this point?
most, probably the majority of what goes on in hospitals, there is no evidence for efficacy, certainly not for high efficacy. And there is grave resistance to the notion because of standardization. So it leads to standardization. CPR.
Wasn't a big controversy with the health bill that was one thing that they wanted to do was evidence.
That's based
on
it.
Works in the movies,
CPR is a good example. CPR.
Like
so
pushing on the
most recent thing. Pushing actually harms. Actually helps. Breathing harms.
Like breathing in their mouth.
Breathing in their mouth. It harms. Right. The way to treat CPR is now is just to have right. But nobody wants to believe that because in theory, breathing works beautifully, but
well,
in practice. Yes, but in practice, we spent billions of dollars and thousands of person hours all over the country training people to do CPR that way, and the outcome on morbidity was nil.
Really?
But if you train people to do, this is the book I read, right? You know, maximum chest compressions, you have a huge increase in efficacy.
What do they teach? Is there a difference between what goes on in hospitals and what goes on, say, on the med?
Because I just saw an episode of Lost, and he hit him a lot on the chest, and nothing happened, and then he breathed into his mouth, and it worked.
So if you read this book by a New York Times health columnist, it started in Milwaukee. Milwaukee is the first place. Jane, whatever her name is, right? It's the one she has a thing about the importance of physical things, and it, right, that was the cheating death. No, there's a book called Cheating Death, different columnist. And that's what they just, you know, and one place finally was willing to test this one guy's theory that this actually worked, and they discovered that it had this huge impact on efficacy. And
which
so
practice was
this? The practice of shifting to that, right? And so now it's spread to a few places. But like that's it.
We're still on like the Heimlich maneuver and stuff.
Heimlich maneuver is a different issue. Heimlich maneuver actually works, but
okay.
We're still into. Right, shout for help, right, breathe in repeatedly, after breathing in do a couple of chest compressions, breathe again, chest compressions, that apparently really doesn't work except in very, very narrow circumstances, maximum chest compressions, that's what you should do. They also have, for example, we discovered administrative changes have radical impacts on hospital outcomes and nobody's really interested in them. Right, efficiency,
yeah.
Right, things like that.
Yeah,
huge.
Stomach works much better than
right. There's a movement in there's a place in Denver that does evidence-based medicine.
Yes.
But doctors are very resistant to this.
Here's something I'm curious. It's marginally relevant. Evidence-based education. Is there a movement for this?
There is a movement for evidence-based education.
It's right here. That's it.
The issue with that is that it's actually discovered that evidence is actually very hard. It's evidence-based education. How do you get a control group? Here's a number of issues. One issue is...
How about just whatever they're doing?
Why
but then
they
try to do that with standardized tests.
Put them in
the
street
and
the other kids you teach math. You see what happens. And then...
No, here's the...
emerges with better life skills in 20 years and have jobs and stay
here's a...
Well, how do you measure success?
Well, you have to work with kids from the same neighborhood.
How do you measure success?
So there are like five or six studies total. There's a site that the Department of Education has called What Works.
Mm-hmm.
Which gives you a whole set of all these educational programs,
mm-hmm.
and the studies that relate to their efficacy, and then an evaluation of whether the studies are scientifically valid.
Mm-hmm.
There are like five studies of 5,000 programs. But here's a very simple. This is how you watch it. It's a very simple model. I have an educational theory.
Okay.
I set up a school.
Okay.
It works.
Right.
Evidence.
Did it work because of right? Did it work because of you, or did it work because of
so
luck?
So we discover, I think, is that education, like many fields, is affected by enthusiasm and energy.
Right.
And enthusiastic, energetic teachers are also the teachers who like to adopt new techniques.
Uh-huh.
So you put in this technique, and what it does is it attracts young enthusiastic teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you try and duplicate it, but when you duplicate it, it no longer is interesting. It's right. So by the fifth school, all of a sudden the results stop, and this happens over and over again.
So maybe we just need to keep on revamping.
Yeah, no. So constant thing just does, you know, has certain, but it has other costs in terms of, but it's very, very, very hard to come up with a genuine control group, and then you want double blinding. How do you do that?
Right.
It's all conscious, right? So it's really very, very hard. You know, it's rare. Every once in a while you get, like, Birthright is this wild thing. Birthright actually has real data, mm-hmm. because there were not enough slots for the program originally, so they actually have a control group of students who were randomly chosen not to get in the Birthright. So the Birthright study is a fascinating thing, because that's actually one of the very, very few things. So there are, in a few places, there are studies of charter schools, right, where there were lotteries to get in.
Uh-huh. And they run.
And they're right. And there they actually run it. Or schools where they assign different teachers of different colleges. Right. There are a few studies, very, very few. Almost impossible to get real evidence of educational efficacy. Even Birthright, you know my whole thing about the Birthright thing? The Birthright study, you know the number of the Birthright study shows for Boston?
The number.
The intermarriage number?
It's supposed to be very low, isn't it? Well, I don't know about Boston. I don't know, like, in general, it's supposed to be very, like...
The Birthright number, Leonard Safkin, is an amazing thing, that the intermarriage rate is cut by 50% by a 10-day trip. It threw me totally for a loop. Like, how can it do this?
Okay.
But it turns out, this is what Lenny Sachs, I have a, you know, he doesn't like me about this. I think he may be right. It doesn't raise the intermarriage rate in the slightest.
Meaning people just don't get married?
Yeah.
Weird.
It's wild. It's absolutely wild. It's absolutely wild. Now, his contention is that because the in-marriage rate has not, the in-marriage to out-marriage rate has not changed, that you can project that the total number of marriages will be the same, and the intermarriage rate will be lower. But right now, all we know is that 10 years later, the number of people, the percentage of people married to non-Jews is identical. Sorry, married to Jews is identical. And the percentage of people married to non-Jews is much lower.
Right. And the percentage of unmarried people is higher.
It's much higher, right? That's the only difference is, that's an amazing, it's a wild thing. Like, you'd never believe a number like that could show up. Right? We're talking 50%.
This is against the control group of people, same age who didn't...
You have 100 people went on Birthright, 100 people didn't. 100 people went on Birthright after 10 years later.
Right.
Let's say 20 of them were married to Jews. And 30 of them will be married to 20 of them will be married to Jews, 20 of them will be married to non-Jews, and 60 of them will be married. And the people who didn't go on Birthright, 20 of them will be married to Jews, and 60 of them will be married to non-Jews, and
right.
20 of them will be married. It's an amazing thing.
So really what it shows is, like, you know, people's exposures afterwards aren't changing. No, the Jews still aren't hanging out with Jews, but they feel guilty about marrying the
non-Jews. So that to me, right.
They just, like, after, you know, this wonderful hedonistic swing to the Middle East, right, they realize I'm not giving any of this stuff up.
Well, 10 years later, right? So I my bet is guilt. Leonard Sachs says, and it's a reasonable one. He says that the if you study engagements, current
engagements broken off,
current living partners, all that, you know, right? There's no hint that all of a sudden there's going to be this massive wave of intermarriage at the 10-year point, which is what it should take. What it would take to even it out. It's all of a sudden. Right, you say all these ones who have been holding off, right? Some point later, they're all of a sudden, right?
They'll get over it.
Right, they'll get over it, and they'll just intermarry.
Okay.
I think that's an amazingly wonderful number.
That's
an amazingly wonderful number, right? And that's a real study. Like, it's, you know, the only study, real study of Jewish education, and it's just like wild. It's just the wildest thing that out could happen. But education.
You have no studies on college campuses, right? No real ones. Like, they've tried, you know. Little things here and there. Obviously, I did something, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's nothing serious. Nothing serious has ever been done.
About
Hillel's? Forget Hillel's. Any organization to talk about religious growth or, you know, lack thereof or loss of religious, you know, conviction walking into campus.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, tons and tons of anecdotal evidence, like, completely contradictory, lots of really entertaining stories,
mm-hmm.
right, but no one knows anything. And these campuses change so radically, it's almost impossible to make it.
Right, that's another issue, you know, in terms of, how do you, even the same school,
right.
Over 5 years.
Yale
right,
pre
Adidas years.
Schwartz. Imagine.
Well, imagine Yale pre the Yale 5.
Yeah.
Right? All of us, you know, what happens if, you know, it may be that you find out later that there was one cool person on campus, right? Right, you know, or one cool staff member, all that, which would totally skews the outcomes. You know, I teach in a high school, right? You can see the population change dramatically in a 5 years.
It's like an Isaac Asimov book.
The mule.
The mule, right.
Yeah,
the mule.
We're all, you know, but you can't, you know, we don't have, like, that's a really, you know, I know, like, I used my own studies on Maimonides to show you know, particular group, like, you know, like I got control of the curriculum, the Talmud curriculum briefly because I showed that in one class there was a control group, kids who had had vocabulary three times the size of the kids who didn't.
Okay.
And Talmud, but that didn't bear out of the whole school, but you know, it could show that one class there were there were kids who and when we tried to. Pardon?
You're saying you basically just got a good class.
I taught that particular class particularly well, but you know, it doesn't mean that doesn't tell you the tactic is what did it.
Right. Or it's just been the fit.
Right. You know. So you can show. So I think I could show at that time. I could show that there were particular teachers whose efficacy was radically affected by using my methods.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't mean there weren't other teachers who were negatively affected. Right, and there again, it might have been an early adoption thing. Also, it's very hard. I still believe in it, but it's hard. And Gannis taught me some of the limitations of that. You know, the cultural requirements. You know, that the, let's say, like grammar-based systems will work really well in cultures that really enforce the importance of grammar, and will totally tank no matter how good the teachers are, if the culture doesn't believe in its significance. And so, you know, non-grammar-based systems, which are the minus, and biologic-based systems, similarly. It doesn't work. It can be affected by what the Tanakh curriculum does.
Sorry, maybe I'm in the wrong century. What's a grammar-based system? It's like,
let's say Tanakh again for years was taught by the first 6 months, just taught you how to use a BDV.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And Talmud was taught the same way again, right? How to use a gesture. Right, so Maimonides, I moved entirely away from a grammar system, and I taught entirely on a symbolic logic-based system where you never actually learn the meanings of the words at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the whole goal is just to understand what their place, right, what their logical placement is. All these require cultural reinforcement, right? And students have to believe in it. Students have to believe in the goals, right? A system which produces results in 8 months, right, requires a culture that will support you for the first 7.5.
And not for the last half month?
It has to be able to deal with you, right? You're right in the 8th month, right? Usually, right? So that's a cultural phenomenon which is utterly irrelevant to the efficacy of the system.
Right.
Right? That depends entirely on motivational requirements, cultural characteristics, all that. So you could, right? And there are so many unique factors. So if you do cancer research now, right, so trying to figure out whether a particular drug is effective, the studies are so micro-specialized, right? And they're so micro-specialized to the point that the jury rigging, that cherry picking is so easy,
mm-hmm.
because there are so many criteria by which you can exclude somebody from your study
that you can hand-pick your base.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's really, that's why. So now what goes on in medicine is meta-studies.
Where they basically take huge groups of studies.
And they try it, right? That's right, because they've given up on the notion that any particular study is statistically significant. And that's starting to happen in education also. But how do you measure the accuracy of a meta study?
Mm-hmm.
It's like judging
meta studies to meta studies.
Tomatoes for education
I'm prepping now for my I'm going to get to teach my course on science and Judaism again,
okay,
where I spend my time just destroying students' notions that I try my best that there actually is a thing called science. And scientific method that they believe in. You know, it's start, you know, the easy one, you walk in and you ask, like, you know, so what is scientific method? Is sense data. Right, and observation. And so we go through, you know, what is there really good sense data of goats, for example?
There's
really good sense data of goats. You have thousands and thousands of eyewitness reports going back thousands of years that ghosts exist. Many, 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 many people have seen them. Nope, that's all illusion. This is like quarks, on the other hand. Quarks are real. everyone believes in quarks.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if you call ghosts quarks, maybe people believe in
that. That's right. No, so, you know, there's a belief system that is built into it. I share the belief system in large measure. But we also do the routine I didn't, you know, share about the demons and I spent a lot of time talking about
demons.
Demons
are causing
diseases.
Demons
are causing
small monocellular demons.
Yes.
Lots of them.
Which eat bacteria, this thing.
Rather, you call them bacteria.
No, that's a mandigan. I think they eat bacteria. I think they're actual demons. You just right, and they're everywhere, right? If you just rub the placenta of a black cat, that was the seventh of the seventh, you would see them.
Okay.
But that's a Gemara, really. Yeah,
I imagine that.
But I think that, you know, the notion of evidence is really, really, evidence for anything other than huge things is very, very hard. Very, very hard to come with anything.
What's huge? Like bigger than a baseball or bigger than a planet?
Huge is, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's not telling you cycle history, right? You know, large measures, you know, you need the whole population.
Right.
And it's very hard to come up with real data that is remotely effective. Because, for example, intuitively teachers will tell you that there's a tipping point of the number of bright students in the class, Now, classes are affected dramatically by that. So how you measure the efficacy, and that's pretty random, right? So how you measure the efficacy of that in any local study, and schools aren't big enough, right? So what's the sample size of a school? Right? Even if I piloted a study of, say, my Talmud method against the Ravadim method in a school, right? So, again, a fairly large Jewish day school has 300 students. Right? So we're going to run a study of 150 versus 150. 150 is not a statistically significant number. Right? So it's very, very hard to get numbers. Mel Levine at some conference last year claimed you have saying, right, the plural of anecdotes is not evidence. But the truth is it is. I mean, there is no other, right, that's all evidence is the plural of anecdotes. And education is never going to have certainly Jewish education,
mm-hmm.
is never going to have the scale that can create genuinely verifiable data. But I used to think that medicine was different. And doing doing cancer research was, what it took. You realize you end up talking to your doctor, and if you go and you have an informed consent with your doctor, and your doctor says, well, yeah, there's that study. I'm not convinced by that study. It doesn't impress me that the guy who does it, he does it not so sharp. That study, I like that. That's a friend of mine. and that's without conscious fraud.
Right, I mean, look, we do that to postmodern.
Yeah, so. But we don't claim it's scientific.
Right, that's true.
We don't claim it's scientific, but that was one of the most fascinating and terrifying things of the past 4 years, was discovering that how much of oncology, for all the scientific veneer, is entirely
somebody tries something and they haven't stopped trying again.
Well, then you just don't know. So it's that patient I know of, right, who had metastatic bone cancer for 20 years without anyone knowing. How do we treat? Do you treat? No one knows. Metastatic bone cancer is supposed to kill you. It turns out that 5% of cases are like that. But nobody knows what to do. It's just like an unknown, mm-hmm. It's just like an unknown phenomenon. You can't assimilate it into the category of what chemo works against, against it, because there's nothing like it. It's not supposed to exist. Right? Most doctors haven't heard of it. If we discover
that cancer that's been there for 20 years.
Yeah. Right. We discover that almost all the screening procedures were counterproductive. Like all the things that people, the last 20 years, we discovered. Right. They know that prostate screening, right, which was was simply a religious belief. Mammograms were a religious belief.
Mm-hmm.
Right. None of them had, and it can't be, because how can you have evidence for 10-year outcomes?
Ten years, yeah.
Right? So the whole notion that you could have any kind of model for that was flawed. You simply can't do it. We discovered certain conceptual flaws. And now, right, we know, like, for example, that almost all the data we had was based on the assumption that progression-free interval and survival were related. Right? That whether the cancer comes back
mm-hmm.
and how long you live are related. It turns out just not to be true. That there, in many, many... many cases, there is no correlation whatsoever.
And the cancer comes back, and people still stay alive, or people die without the cancer coming back?
Basically, the cancer doesn't come back for a long time, then it comes back.
The cancer doesn't come back, then it comes back faster, or it would have grown slowly.
Oh, okay.
Right? Or you could control it all along as a chronic illness, right? But wiping it out for 6 months Right, really, in many, many cases, has absolutely no effect on prognosis. Hmm. But people tested, well, the way of testing tumor drugs was by whether they shrank tumors.
Right.
But if you're dealing with a 10-year survival rate, so what kind of, if it takes a 10-year study, the consequence of that is that nobody gets any, right, no, the treatments take 10 years to be approved. Right, many, many people die in the process. And aside from the question whether shrinking tumors work, that was also like angiogenesis was a fascinating thing where they had this really, everyone thought Judafokin was crazy. They said, no, you can't attack cancers that way. I mean, it doesn't have any effect. It turned out he was right, that angiogenesis inhibitors work, but they work in unfortunate ways because it turns out that the, or at least possibly, that one of the ways in which cancer cells work is by sending out distress signals. And those distress signals are increased when they're starved of oxygen. So there's a short-term effect, right, of starving it, but the result of that is that it increases the, increases the chances of so all these things, but no one had any idea. And yet everyone thought what we were doing was scientific. You know, and some of the research was scientific, but the medicine wasn't. The medicine was all guessed on. Anyway, this is a separate speech. I don't think education is going to be any different. That's the bottom line. I don't think education is going to be any different. And the Jewish education is much, much harder because the sample size is smaller. There's, right, the money is less. So I don't know. Look, cancer is huge sums.
Right.
If you want to find out anything about unsexy diseases, right, you know, people discover there's almost nothing.
Right.
And that's hard to deal with, but, you know, that there's no thing that frustrated us endlessly is all sorts of things we wanted to try about which there simply aren't any studies. And you can't do it because of the studies unscientific. And so that's what you make the movies about. But it turns out you can. It turns out that there are, right, so there's, like, we have a family friend who's an oncologist. So he just set up his own clinic, doesn't accept insurance, so he can't be constrained by standard of care.
So he just does what he wants?
He just does what he wants. No one believes
his studies. He's saying they're all running his own practice.
Right, but he's not vulnerable to malpractice?
Sure, he's vulnerable.
Oh, okay.
They have insurance, the insurance company's willing to cover it.
Okay, if the insurance company's willing to cover him, fine.
The best thing you can do is to be silent. Good. And you can come over to me and we can go over it afterwards. That's fine.
And I haven't, I know it's other things to deal, but half of the term is me anyway.
So that you can ask. Anything you but you should come. You should come to me, Sifai, and we can spend time going over it. But the best thing you can do is to learn the language. And get exposed to the language as much as possible and learn it, learn it. Because you're so smart, Sifai.
I'm so bad at this.
No, you're not, Sifai. You're the, as good a 12-year-old girl as there is in the world at this, I would think. Name me one 12-year-old girl who's better.
I don't know yet.
Well, we should go over it, don't we? We'd be frustrated. We should go over the text. We should read them and discuss them together again.
Can I name you people the potential to be as good as I am?
No. I don't care. I'm sure there are some.
There are a lot. Most of them don't care.
Right?
Well, most of them think, well, most of them feel sort of cowed and they don't really want to be. Because they're afraid they won't be as good.
Mm-hmm. So don't fall into that trap.
Yeah, I'm a dancing crane.
Dancing crane. Which
one? Kobayashi Maru.
Okay, is that Sulu's grandfather?
Yeah, Sulu's great grandfather.
Sulu's great grandfather. I don't remember why that's relevant. Oh, he's telling not to be the dancing crane. He's supposed
to be the dancing crane. Because the reason cranes always have one leg up is because they're really clumsy, but there are some cranes which can walk. And the cranes will put their legs down, and you have to be brave enough to put your leg down. And the ones who, and some of them can dance, some of them can't. The ones who look at the dance, who tried and looking at the dancing cranes, and they know what they could have.
I had like my nice organized search myself. I fight. I should probably buy a second copy. My computer still won't upload.
Okay.
So, can I stick this into yours and give you the files?
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to convert the call yet, but I can get you up in 3-4 days and we can stay. I don't know why my computer desk is. I think it may be.